One. You have sound. Baruch Hashem. Okay. Sister Debbie is giving a halachic ruling. Debbie was just giving us a halachic ruling.
No reading the scriptures in the bathroom. That's what she says. Any place where you can smell, shall we say, the products of elimination. Of course, if the wife were to clean the bathroom, it wouldn't be a problem.
Shalom. And I would like to welcome you all to the Beit Yaakov. And someone says, oh, you're in so much trouble.
She's been putting up with that kind of stuff for 28 years. That's not going to change anything.
Okay, the scriptures for today is Exodus 12:29-51, Isaiah 21:11, Psalm 49, and Revelation 18:1-24. And last week we had a good discussion from you all on Pal Talk. So, Dumrod, Watered Garden, everybody, we want to hear from you. And all of you, what are your thoughts and comments? So with that, type it in text. If I don't see it, just keep going and I'll see it eventually. And so with that, we will turn things over to the Peanut Gallery with any thoughts, questions, and comments on Exodus 12:29-51.
Okay, Peanut Gallery. What you got on Exodus 12:29-51? Let's read 29 to, let's see. Let's go to 43. Let's go to 36, rather. That's a couple of paragraphs. At least the way that the King James has it broken up. And here it goes. And it came to pass that at midnight Yahweh smote all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on his throne, unto the firstborn of the captive and was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of cattle. Now you see, there's that Siddur showing itself again right there, because the Pharaoh was sitting on his throne. The Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. And he called for Moshe and Aharon by night and said, rise up and get you forth from among thy people, both ye and the children of Israel, and go serve Yahweh as ye have said. Also take your flocks and your herds as ye have said, and be gone and bless me also. And the Egyptians were urgent upon the people that they might send them out of the land in haste, for they said, we will all be dead men. And the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading troughs being bound up in their clothes upon their shoulders. And the children of Israel did according to the word of Moshe, and they borrowed from the Egyptians jewels of silver, and jewels of gold, and raiment. And Yahweh gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they lent unto them, and they spoiled the Egyptians. Okay. We got any questions or comments up until that point there? Let's see. 29 says, it came to pass that at midnight the Yahweh smote all the firstborn of the land of Egypt. It doesn't say firstborn males. It says firstborn, period. Okay, so if there wasn't a firstborn male, I'm sure a firstborn daughter would have done just fine. Not the way that Hollywood depicted it, no. But then it's also speaking in Hebraic sense, and the firstborn is the male. Anyway, let's see. Verse 31, perseverance pays off. Exodus 10:26 and Mark 4:20. The date is Aviv 15, 2554 Anno Mundi. So it's the 2554th day of creation, or year of creation, rather, on Aviv 15. That day, get up and go. Now, Pharaoh asks to be blessed. Was this blessing merely the fact that Moshe and Israel would be gone? Or was Pharaoh actually I can't read what I've got here. That's what I get for writing so tiny. Oh, was he actually asking him for himself and as king for a blessing? What do you think? Was Pharaoh asking that he would be blessed by Moshe, or by Yahweh for letting him go, or was he actually saying, "Get out of here, that'll be a blessing"?
Verse
32. As I was reading the Chumash this morning in preparation for this, I was reading what I thought was my Chumash, and it turns out to be my son's. And I'm writing in it, thinking that it's mine, when in fact it's his. Uh-oh, and boy, is he angry with me. You wrote in my book! I hate it when people write in my books. I don't have anything written in here for verse 32. So, I don't have anything written in here for verse 32.
You don't have it. I don't know. 32, and then go to 29, and it mentions the first born.
Okay. Okay, here we go. Pharaoh's... Oh, okay. The tenth plague, death of the firstborn. Every firstborn. Pharaoh was the only firstborn to be spared so that he could tell all the world about God's greatness. The plague struck down not only those who were born, known to be the firstborn, but also the eldest children of men who live with women other than their wives. In a country as licentious as Egypt, this meant that a woman could have had many firstborn whose paternity was known only to Elohim. In addition, if there were no firstborn in a house, the oldest member of the household died. This is why the next verse states that there was a dead person in every house, and why the Egyptians could think, in verse 33, that they were all dying, according to the Rashi. Is Mashiach now in the room? No? No, because I got a comment for him, because Rashi is one of his favorites. And I just wanted to tell him, man, I'll tell you what, this is Rashi. In this particular passage, Rashi shows that he's a pretty sharp cat. He knows what he's talking about. Okay. That's all right. Other questions or comments? You got anything over there, Bill?
Just that I sort of headlined this, that no, there is a Yahweh that judges the earth. And true to Yahweh's word, which is truth, right at midnight, that's when they die. And all the way from the top of the line all the way down to the poorest. And so some of those poor people that didn't even know anything about what was going on, they lost theirs too. To me, it seems that there's many a time that the sinners make their own snares in which they cause entanglement and they fall into a pit. And the reason they fall into a pit is that the sin that they commit, and they're trying to blame Yahweh or somebody else for the problems that they have. And we see that in today, you know. And it says that the cry in Egypt was great. I mean, it went out throughout the land. But they have to understand that this was a divine retribution for the Egyptians for what they had done. So when Yah called Moses and Aaron to gather all the people and their belongings, this was a fulfillment of what was said in Moses' words in 11:8, that they would do this. This shows to me that this was a divine suggestion that was made. That he already had said it before, and this is exactly what took place here. And I thought it was interesting when the kneading trough, so I sort of looked up about it. This was like the Egyptian type, because they were in Egypt, and that's, after all these years, this is what they used. These troughs were made into a shape of a bowl, from my understanding. It was either made out of rush or wicker, and they were very light, easy to carry, and they could carry them under their loose garments, which they did, with the unleavened, according to what the word said. Now, it says that according to the instructions of Moses, the people borrowed from the Egyptians gold and silver, and Yahweh gave them favor with the Egyptians, and they, quote, lent this gold and silver, and whatever they asked for them, they said just to get rid of them, you know. And this is what is called a spoiling. They spoiled the Egyptians. Now, the question is, did the Israelites need the gold and silver? No, they did not need the gold and silver. However, Yahweh did need the gold and the silver that we'll see later on in the chapters. Yeah, not at this time. So it was really for him, although it was a payment for all the work that they had done and never got paid, all of it went back to Yahweh. It all was given to Yahweh.
It's very interesting. We were reading through here a couple of years ago, and at that time there was the Egypt was threatening to bring a suit against Israel in the world court for all the gold and silver that they'd taken out of there, you know, spoiling the Egyptians. And then the Israelis said, well, that'll be fine, but we're going to countersue for all of our back pay for all those 400 years that we were in bondage. Okay, so I think probably you ought to just shut up and we'll call it even.
Watered Garden had a point. She said, isn't it interesting that in the end, the king who tried to keep Israel from receiving a blessing, in the end, asked Israel for a blessing?
See, that is very interesting. In verse 35 and 36, which we also covered, Hashem gave the people favor in the eyes of the Egyptians, and they granted their request. I'm reading from the Stone Siddur. So they emptied Egypt. It says in the King James, they add five or six words in verse 36. Such things as they required. That is not in the original. And And Yahweh gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they lent unto them. They spoiled them, right? But so they emptied Egypt. But lent isn't really the word. It says here that they granted their request. Israel went out and they asked for the gold and silver, and Egypt said, "Here, please take it, get out, go here, take here. How much more do you want? Wait a minute." You know, like they. Here's what the Chumash has to say about that. Carried out the word of Moshe. 5 states merely that the Jews asked to borrow various items. Verse 36, which begins by saying that God caused the Egyptians to like the Jews, and ends by saying that the Jews emptied Egypt of its wealth, implies that the Egyptians gave away indeed, according to Or HaChaim, forced valuables upon the Jews, more than the Jews had asked for. Rashbam comments that because Hashem gave the people favor in the eyes of the Egyptians gave lavish gifts, not loans, of their valuables. So that whole idea of loaning it was not the truth. Egypt gave it to them. Rashi cites the Mechilta that if a Jew asked for one item, the Egyptians would insist that he take 2, as long as he left the country. Please, take this and get out. Is basically what Egypt was saying to Israel. Please, take this gold, take this silver, please take it, get out of here. Because if you don't leave, we're going to end up not doing what Yahweh wants us to do, and he's going to kill us all. Because, I mean, what else was left? Okay, I've warned you through all your gods, I've warned you in your firstborn, now what's left? He wipes out everybody.
It's interesting here on the word lent here, and the side note here, it says gladly gave. If the Hebrew verb is in the hippel mode, and it means to cause them to ask, i.e. the Egyptians pressed them to take.
Exactly.
They come in and say, take this, which is really the word lent is a poor rendition of what really took place at that time.
Question, comment. It would be kind of a correlation to when Daniel was the prophet, I can't remember the king's name, the writing on the wall, when God came and he wrote on the wall, Belshazzar, yeah, and he knew he was going to die, but he tried to appease Yahweh by giving gifts. Would it be like that?
I don't know, but I think that Belshazzar had crossed the line completely when he took the gold and silver that was taken from the house of Yahweh and was blessing his own gods by drinking from them. I think probably that kind of ticked Yahweh off a little bit. whether or not that was, I suppose that's a possibility. Okay. Yeah, please, just...
Yeah. Bless your people, so don't judge me anymore.
Yeah, well, that could very well be that was what they were thinking. Yeah. Interesting that in verse 31, Pharaoh says, as you have spoken. Okay? Pharaoh's arrogant defiance was completely broken. This is from the Chumash. Not only was he anxious that the people leave Egypt immediately, he had withdrawn all of his reservations and conditions. Gone was his insistence that the children remain behind. Gone was his insistence that the livestock remain behind. Now he urged Moses and Aaron to do whatever they pleased, as you have spoken, provided they leave the country. Just get out. Please, do whatever you want to do, just get out of here. And do me a favor, on your way out, bless me as well. You know, it was like an aside. Any questions or comments? Anyone else? continuing on. There was a lot of really good stuff in this Chumash today, and I need to pass this on. Pharaoh came running through the streets, looking for Moshe and Aharon. It was at midnight. Pharaoh rose up at midnight, he and all his servants and all Egypt. He got up and he went looking for Moses himself. Instead of going back to Goshen, Moses and Aaron had stayed in Egypt proper for the night because Moshe had told Pharaoh that courtiers would come to him bowing and asking the Jews to leave. That was in 11:8. Moshe then sent angels to Goshen to tell the Jews to assemble in Ramesses the next morning for the Exodus. Whether Moshe had angels at his to do his bidding, or I mean, we're talking angels as in spirits from God. I don't know, but angels could also just mean messengers. He may have had some messengers with him. So, according to the Mechilta, Moses responded to the Egyptian insistence for an immediate departure by saying, "Are we thieves that we should depart at night? We will leave with an upraised arm, i.e., proudly, in full view of all Egypt." And you know what? They didn't leave until the next morning. They did. They gathered at Ramesses, and that was where they left from there, and they went to Sukkot, where they got the bones of Joseph, and then they took off. And we'll see that next week or the week after. Other questions or comments? We are through verse 36. Okay. From the really inspired commentary, the one that's written in the margins of Mark's Bible, we get this from verse 36. The war was over. Egypt lost. So Israel gets the victor's spoils, but without violence from the loser. They defeated the most powerful nation in the world without firing a shot. Okay, is America listening to this?
Yeah.
They defeated the most powerful nation in the world, and they never did anything. Okay, they didn't shoot an arrow, they didn't throw a stone, nothing. They did not fight. They let Yahweh do their fighting for them, and you see what happened. Yeah, my son says, yeah, well, Aaron had to raise his staff up over the land of Egypt. He had to put the staff, he had to touch the staff to the River Nile. But he didn't do it. Yeah, it wasn't Aaron and his staff that did it. It was Yahweh that did all the work.
It was the true staff, the staff of light, that did it.
There you go. Why don't you pick up a mic and say that?
I said it was the true staff, the staff of life, that did it.
So from Eddie, we get this. It talks about midnight, that Yahweh went out at midnight, and midnight is indicative of the tribulation. Go ahead.
Just something that kind of pops in my head, and maybe we had already touched on it while I was out of the room, but do you think the Israelites were scattered all over Egypt when this happened, or were they all contained in a single city?
No, they were all in Goshen. They were all in Goshen. That's where they lived. The Egyptians wouldn't let them into the country proper because they were abomination to the Egyptians. Yeah. So that's that. They were all in Goshen, and he said, "Meet me in Ramesses in the morning, and we're going to Sukkot first thing." So that's what they did.
Someone wanted to. Can someone address the matter of firstborn Was it the firstborn of the father or the first to open the womb?
It says first that opens the matrix. So that means the firstborn, first child out of the woman. Now, that's not the only way to think of the firstborn. The answer to the question is probably yes. Okay? The first one that... when Yahweh gives the orders in chapter 13, or rather later in chapter 12, he tells them about the Passover. There's going to be a firstborn, and the firstborn will be the first one to cross the matrix, firstborn child of a woman. And I think that's probably the source of saying that a Jew has to have a Jewish mother. Okay? But I'm not sure about that. But that makes sense to me. But I really do believe that the answer is yes, because as one of the rabbis said here, there could be women who had four or five children who were the firstborn sons of the man. And therefore, she would have lost four or five firstborn children. Okay? Children that only God could have known whom the firstborn were. Or who were the firstborn. Do you have a question, David? Give him a mic.
I was thinking about Genesis chapter... Hang on. I have to find it real quick. It was about Jacob and Esau's birth. One stuck their hand out before. So
Jacob stuck his hand out.
Pulled it back in.
Yeah, and then Esau came out.
So was he technically the firstborn?
Esau was the firstborn.
But Jacob was the one who stuck his hand
out. That's why he got... I think probably in Yahweh's eyes it was, since what we're going to see in later on is that the first one that crosses the matrix is the firstborn.
So
therefore Jacob was the firstborn. But since Esau was the first baby out, he was considered to be the firstborn by his father, and therefore was more highly favored by his father.
Okay, Water Garden says, please ask this. If it's only male firstborn, the reason I think this is because later in the text, it's only male firstborn who are redeemed by shekels.
That is true. I think that the reason that the rabbis said that it was firstborn no matter male or female is because there wasn't a house that didn't have a dead person in it. And therefore it was, it could very well be that there were houses that didn't have any sons. And therefore the firstborn would be the firstborn daughter. And remember that the daughters of Zelophehad, who I think that's the correct father. Anyway, the guy had four daughters or five daughters and no sons, and so those daughters got a portion in the land.
One of them's name was Noah.
One of them's name was Noah? Yeah, cool. So anyway, so when there wasn't a firstborn son, a firstborn daughter works. I think that makes sense. Other questions or comments? We can move on to the next paragraph from 37 to 42. And the children of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Sukkot, about 600,000 on foot that were men, beside children. And a mixed multitude went up also with them, and flocks and herds, even very much cattle. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought forth out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not tarry, neither had they prepared for themselves any victual. Now the sojourning of the children of Israel, who dwelt in Egypt, was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day, it came to pass that all the hosts of the Lord, of Yahweh, went up from Egypt, from the land of Egypt. It is a night to be much observed with unto Yahweh for bringing them out from the hand of from the land of Egypt. This is that night of Yahweh to be observed by all the children of Israel in their generations. You got something, Bill? You got something, Dan? You got something, Stephen?
Yeah.
Let's hear it.
I think it's interesting that they left Ramses, which not a very good place to be, and he went right to Sukkot. No passing. I mean, you know, that's awesome. It gives you a figure of sorts of how many people with the number of men on foot plus the children. Of course, you had the women and everything in there. Some of the commentary says there's 2,400,000 total with the multitude. Now, I don't know how they arrived at that figure, but it's just... I think it's interesting when it says a mixed multitude, meaning that there was the Egyptians that were there, and if the Assyrians were in charge, which this Pharaoh, from my understanding, was an Assyrian, because he knew not Joseph, that maybe some of those people left too after what was happening. I don't know. But it does say a mixed multitude with the flocks and the herds. They had a whole parcel of cattle and so forth that went with them. If you don't believe it, go to Numbers 1 and then go to Numbers 11:4 and Deuteronomy 29:11. It'll give you some figures there, I guess.
You know, I think that 2.4 million is a pretty low figure. They're figuring just for a man and his wife and two children.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we're not talking about 21st century America.
No.
We're talking about, you know, 15th, 16th century before the Common Era, when they had children, you know, let's face it, they were kind of like Amish, you know, or Catholics, you know. As many kids as they could pump out, that's how many they had.
Yep.
You know, because they needed, really and truly, I think the reason that we're not doing what they did is because we live in cities and we don't need to have 100,000 kids to take care of our property, to keep the farm going, take care of the animals, that kind of stuff. And so we've become very lazy in all things, including having children. But I think that probably we have would be closer if we were to say that there were 300 or 3 million or 4 million that came out of Egypt, and even that would be low, I think.
Yeah, I didn't see the figure. I just saw it was like, to me it was like they threw out a figure like a guesstimate, yeah. You know. But it doesn't mean that really holds much water. Zechariah meant about the mixed multitude. The mixed multitude could refer rather to what Zechariah spoke of in Zechariah 8:23 in part. We know that it says that their sojourn was 430 years, accounting that they were in Egypt 215 years. Is that right? 215 years?
That's pretty close.
And they
actually in Egypt.
And their traveling was like 215 years, which would equal out.
Well,
how would that figure?
Well, let me.
That equals out to 430.
Yeah.
I
can give you what the there's a big section in the Chumash about the number of people that came out, and you go ahead and do what you're doing, and then I'll share that.
I'm just saying if it was 215 years, the rest of it they had to be traveling or something had to, but it had nothing to do with them. It had to do with who came out first, you know, in the land? Wasn't it? That how they figured it off of?
The prophecy was given in Genesis chapter 15.
Right.
And if you look at Abraham's age, Yitzhak's, mm-hmm. Jacob's, all of his children, the children that went into Egypt, if you count it from the time that the prophecy was given, and you go 430 years, you're pretty darn close.
So it started with Abraham, who was on a sojourn.
Yeah, well, you start with Abraham, who was put to sleep,
right?
Okay, and given the prophecy,
mm-hmm.
and that day was the 15th of Aviv.
Okay, so that started it.
Then 30 years later, his son, Yitzhak, was born on the 15th of Aviv. 400 years after that, they come out of Egypt on the 15th of Aviv.
So that gives you the number here. In verse 42, it talks about the night that he was talking about in which they left Egypt was to be remembered. It says, in each generation. Now, if that is true, and we are children of Abraham, and we are, and the church has that song that the kids sing called Father Abraham. If they acknowledge that he is their father, they too should be remembering that very day. And they don't do it.
Right.
So they're on the other side, the flip side of what Yahweh wants them to do. They're wrong.
They're on the left side of the Torah, not the right side of the Torah.
They're on the left side of the Torah. Right.
Other questions or comments?
Mashiach now is back.
There he is. Hey, and that Rashi dude's pretty sharp, isn't he, there, Mashiach now?
He says that the mixed multitude here, the heir of Rav, are the ancestors of Bush and Olmert.
He's absolutely correct. I believe, if not physically, certainly the same spirit. Absolutely.
I was wondering the population growth. From the time that Jacob and the 70 children of Israel came in to the time that they left with the 600,000 men plus women and children, what would be the average family size over the 200 and some years?
They multiplied by rabbits.
Faster than rabbits. We're talking the family size had to be in the 10 to 15 children per family.
But it didn't happen.
It didn't happen in the ensuing early years. This was the latter part, and I think we discussed it, but I can't remember the years, probably how many years from the time. There was basically 70 there.
I would think mostly in the time from Moshe's birth until they left. I would think in those last 80 years they...
It had to be with... That's phenomenal. I mean, that's a birth. It isn't like in China where they have so many births because they have these millions of people. You're talking 70 people, and all of a sudden... We're walking out of there with a few million people. That's phenomenal.
David, I want you to tell us about the record number of births for one man and one woman, and tell us what it is and how it happened.
The record number of births between one man, one woman couple was back in the 1800s in Russia. 69 kids.
Wow.
There were 14 twins, 7 triplets, and 5 quadruplets.
Not a single birth among them. And that is how this happened in Israel. It could very well be that there was not a single birth among them. It could very well be that Moshe and Aharon and Miriam are pretty close to the same age. They might be the same age.
You know, there's a little story about the guy. He went into the Biltmore house, and he wanted to get a room. He asked if there was any bed bugs in it. And he says, "Nah, there's none here." And the guy was right. They were all married and had children.
Okay, so I'm looking at verse 37, and I'm thinking they had to have at least 4 million came out of there. Okay, 600,000 men. We're only talking about a wife and 4 kids for each family. Okay, I mean, that's not unheard of. But if we had multiple births and twins and triplets and quadruplets being born to those women, you know, we could be talking about 15, 20 million walking out of there. I mean, if, capital if, right. What I'm, you see what I'm saying? 600,000 men just gives you a number of how many men came out of there. It doesn't tell you how many total. It could, only the important ones were numbered. That's right.
And the mixed multitude. We don't know how many of the mixed multitude.
And there was the mixed multitude, the heir of Rav.
It could have been some of those people might have latched on to the coattail of a Jew.
Oh, you know what? In order for them to be coming out of there, they had to have been circumcised and kept the Passover.
That's true, too. I never thought of that like that. Yeah. They might have been people that had a belief, had been around and had seen all the miracles, or maybe before that in some of the homes they were still doing the right things and teaching them the right way, and they might have accepted that, you know, of that fact. That's good. That's true.
Well, I was going to make a comment, but Wiggy beat me to it. She said, bless those midwives. Shipara and Pua.
Amen.
Those...
Okay, there were 600,000 Hebrew men and their families and Egyptian believers, the mixed multitude. I imagine there were a bunch of Gentile converts after all that transpired. Boy, isn't that the truth? It's just way too interesting. Looking at the possibilities of what could be here, given the facts that were given, and just extrapolating a little bit. Okay. Verse 37. 38, the mixed multitude. This is from the Chumash. A mixed multitude. A multitude of people of various nationalities converted to Judaism and accompanied the Jews out of Egypt. They had to have been seceded, or they couldn't circumcised, or they could not have come out of there. They had to have been converted. They had, now, the conversion process probably didn't take anywhere near as long as it does now. Okay? The conversion process could be, hey, you know what? You guys are worshiping the real God, and we've been worshiping the wrong gods. I want to follow your God. And so, well, you know what? Be circumcised, and you're fine. And that's that. And you know what? Once these plagues started to hit Egypt, you know, we're pretty much, you know, we're showing the Egyptians that all of their gods are useless. Only Yahweh is a true God. Okay? All these other guys, I mean, the lice and, you know, all the different things that were destroyed that were gods in Egypt. These people are finally saying, you know what? Those guys are not gods. The God that's wiping them out, that's a God. That's the God I want to follow. And so they come to the Israelites and they say, you know what? I want to follow your God. I don't want to follow the God I've been following. And so I think that's what happened. We could have a mixed multitude as big or bigger than Israel. Now let's talk about possibilities of how many people came out of that land. I mean, possibility is we have 20 million people coming out of there. You know, could have been a huge number. Go ahead.
Of a nation of about 50 million after the plague of the firstborn, killing off some million, and then 15, 20 million coming out, they were quite weak at the time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then, you think about what we're going to see in chapter 13 and 14. Egypt comes out after them. And what is it? 600 chariots? And 600 charioteers, therefore. And all their horses. And then the attendants to the charioteers who are riding in the chariot with them. We're talking and all of the foot soldiers and everybody... It was a huge number of Egyptians that got wiped out in the Red Sea, too. I mean, there was nothing left of that nation, or next to nothing left.
I'd like to talk about leaven. There was unleavened cakes. The definition of unleavened is one that's baked in haste. Doesn't have a chance to rise. One other time this happened that I know of prior to this, and that was when the three, quote, strangers came to Abraham's tent.
Yeah.
She said, he said, bake them.
Make
haste and bake them. So what they ate was unleavened bread at that time. I thought that's pretty interesting.
I remembered from one of my history books that around the time of the Hebrew Exodus, that the Egyptians went into a depression of sorts. It's called the Third Intermediate Period, from 1070 to about 712, and they were conquered and made tributaries of countless kings. So,
including Shlomo, that the timing of that is a little bit late. Because this is happening more like 1450.
Well, yeah.
Or so, but...
But that was a contributing factor to
Oh, absolutely.
Big time.
Absolutely. There was no way for them to recover in 200 or 300 years. Unless Yahweh smiled on them like he did to Israel, and while they were in that land, 70 people going in and 4 or 5 million coming out.
We had a question, Servant 60. How long did it take the children of Israel to come out of Egypt?
I'm going to conjecture. I'm not sure exactly how long it took. I know this. They left Ramesses, they went to Sukkot. They camped there overnight, I believe, in Sukkot, while they were gathering up Joseph's bones to take back with them. Then they left that following morning on the 16th to cross the Sinai Peninsula. They got to, I forget what the name of the town is, Itam, I think, is at the top of the wadi that runs down to Nueva. Anyway, it took them, I would think, about a week. I think they made one stop on the way to rest. And they took them a week to get from Sukkot to Nueva while they're on the shore of the Red Sea. And, Elam?
Over in 16, they took their journey to Elam.
Okay, that's right. Elam, that's the place in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula. And from the from that place, they were able to... what's that?
You know, the second month after they departed out of the land of Egypt, they went into the wilderness of Sin.
I don't have a good enough map here. Oh, I got one in the back of my Bible. Oh, hang on a minute. My maps, the maps in my Bible are inspired, so you can trust this. Okay, let's see. Yes. Etam is the name of the thing, I think. And it's at the head of the wadi that runs down to Nueva, which is where the crossing site of the Red Sea was at. It was about 40 times about 4, about a 250-mile trip, which on foot, day and night, you could probably do with Yahweh strengthening you, you could probably make that in 5 or 6 days. It would be a lot of work, but I think you could, with Yahweh supernaturally strengthening you, could very well be done. Oh boy, you know what? Part of the thing that they did in the wilderness, you know, they only moved 42 times from Sinai to Jericho. There were only 42 moves, but I think that they were getting ready throughout that time that they were in the camped at Sinai and Rephidim, I think they were working on getting their act in gear quickly, because I think they could tear down and be ready to move within a very short time, under an hour. You know, so the possibility exists that they could have moved like this, and you know, especially with the scenario that I put out of them being able to move for 3 days without a stop, could very well that they made it in less than a week. As I don't think it took very much longer than that for Egypt to come out of their mourning, and in their mourning decide, well, we got to get them back. We got to kill them, or we got to get them back. And so they ran after him. Because we'll see it when we get there. They decided, well, you know what, we were pretty stupid to let all those people go. So, other questions or comments here? I would like to read what the Chumash has about the duration of the Exodus, of the exile, rather. This is a little bit lengthy, so bear with me. Although the verse gives duration of Israel's stay in Egypt as 430 years, it's clear that the nation could not have been in Egypt that long, for the lifetimes of Kehot, who came with Jacob, and his son Amram, total only 270 years. And Amram's son Moshe was 80 at the time of the Exodus. Rather, the rabbinic tradition, as cited by Rashi, Moshiach now, this Rashi cat is pretty sharp, listen up, is as follows. The covenant between the parts in Genesis chapter 15, verses 7 to 21, took place 430 years before the Exodus, and that is the period referred to in our verse. At that time, Elohim foretold to Abraham that his offspring would endure 400 years, during which there would be exile, persecution, and servitude, but not necessarily all of them at the same time. Those 400 years began with the birth of Yitzhak, since the prophecy referred to Abraham's offspring in Genesis 15:13. Thus, the Exodus was perfectly calibrated to conform to the prophecy to Abraham, for Yitzhak was born in the 15th of Nisan, and exactly 400 years later, precisely at the deadline, at the end of the prescribed time in verse 41, the Jews were liberated. The actual sojourn in Egypt lasted 210 years, according to Rashi. Accordingly, the verse's reference to 430 years is the time they dwelled in Egypt, means that the Egyptian exile had been decreed 430 years before the Exodus. Rambam cites this chronology as an illustration of how prophecies are often understood completely only after they come to pass. Until the Exodus, it was not known if the 400 years were to be dated from the prophecy of Abraham, the birth of Yitzhak, Yaakov's descent into Egypt, or the beginning of the Egyptian servitude. A sizable number of the tribe of Ephraim, convinced that the 400 years began from the covenant, attempted a mass escape 30 years before Exodus, and many were slaughtered by the Philistines, according to the Sanhedrin's 92b. In this regard, Rav Bachya notes that we too, in the current exile, should take heart and have faith that the prophecies of the Messianic redemption will come true. And when that happens, we will understand the full meaning and the manner of complete fulfillment of all the prophecies. Now, in light of that, look at Luke chapter 24 and verse 27, where you will see this. Hang on a second. Luke 24 and 27 says this, "And beginning at Moshe and all the prophets, he expounded unto them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself." Yeshua, after his resurrection, after his death and resurrection, was able to show these people from the scripture where it was prophesied that he would be crucified and be resurrected. And it was only then that they could understand it. Okay? Only then could they understand it. That's what the rabbis are saying here. I'm going to tell you something. Those of you out there who are talking with regular Jews, not Messianic Jews, and they're telling you that there's no way that Yeshua could be Messiah. Here's a little bit of ammunition for you. Yes, he could. There's the only reason that you're saying that he's not is because your rabbis are telling you it's not true. You need to look at the evidence. Now that he's died and been resurrected, you can look at all these things that the Christian church has been saying are prophecies of Yeshua, and look at them in that light, because now you can understand this. Okay? Just like they were able to understand the 400 years, the 430 years, only after the fulfillment of the 430 years. See? You can use the parallel and make a midrash for them, and maybe they'll understand. Other questions or comments out there?
And maybe Moshiach now wants to sort of would go along. He has a link from, I forget where it was, but it's from a rabbinic writing that the Moshiach can rise from the dead. So maybe he wants to post that, because it's interesting. It would also go along with that, what Mark said.
Absolutely. If you can make the connection in somebody's mind, look, Yahweh gave this prophecy, and nobody could understand it. I mean, look, these Ephraimites that were in Egypt, after 400 years, they rebelled against Egypt thinking that that's the end of their 400 years. When in fact, they had 30 years to go, but they couldn't understand it until after it was over. Once it was over, then we could understand why it was going to happen that way, how it was going to happen, and we can understand that. Exactly the same thing with the prophecies in the Tanakh about Messiah. There's no way that we can understand it if we don't recognize the fact that Mashiach died and was resurrected. If we see that, then we can see all of this other stuff that Yahweh prophesied hundreds and thousands of years before. Other questions or comments? My son says he has a comment, but he's over there getting a cup of coffee, so we're going to have to wait for him. Come on over here, Daniel. Daniel's back from Colorado. He was here with us for Pesach. He did 3 Pesachs this year at his fellowship out in Colorado Springs. They had a first night Pesach in a family's home. Then they had a second night Pesach with the community, and then he got on an airplane the following morning and flew here, and we had Pesach here. Isn't that cool? That boy is really full of matzah right now. Full of other things too, but...
All right, just something I noticed in 39, the last half of it. Because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not tarry, neither had they prepared for themselves any victuals. When we have our Exodus, let us have the same kind of faith that they had on their way out, that the Father will be providing for us, and we should, that doesn't mean we shouldn't prepare, we should keep learning, keep educating ourselves in the process, but when the time comes, just to remain faithful and trusting.
Yep, they ate unleavened because they were in a hurry and couldn't wait for the dough to rise. Not out of obedience to the commandment, I think. They were forced out. They didn't have a chance to let that rise. Egypt said, get out. Here's your gold, here's your silver, get out. Go ahead, go worship Yahweh, sacrifice to Him, take everything, just get out of my country. And I think they were forced out. I think they were forced out at the point of a spear. Other questions or comments? It's interesting. In verse 41, it says, And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day, it came to pass that all the hosts of Yah went out from the land of Egypt. The selfsame day, and exactly the same day of the year. So they came out on the 15th of Aviv. This tells you that Abraham was put into that deep sleep on the 15th of Aviv. And we know already that Yitzhak was up on the mount on the 15th of Aviv, on his birthday, by the way. He was probably about 30 years old. Yeah, he was not some little boy like you see in the flannel graphs. You know, those flannel graphs were great for getting the story out to little kids, but they're not doctrinally sound.
So he was stronger than his father, and
absolutely,
and he laid down to be tied up because he was obedient unto death.
He was stronger than his father, like Daniel's stronger than me.
Yeah.
Oh no, very. I'm just a weak old fat man. You're a young, vital. I'll tell you what. I may outweigh you by 100 pounds, but that's one of the reasons that I'm weak. Okay. 430 years to the day. Was this the very day of the year in which Yahweh promised Abe in Genesis 15:13? Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Other questions or comments? Up to verse 42. There's an interesting comment in the Chumash. This is really good. On verse 42. The word in question is Shimurim. Okay? Shimurim, the Hebrew word. It's translated two different ways in the same verse. The same word is used twice, translated two different ways. Anticipation and protection. Okay, if you look in 43. This is the decree of the Pesach offering. I'm sorry. What? In 42, I'm sorry. Verse 42. It is a night of anticipation for Hashem to take them out of the land of Mitzrayim. This was the night for Hashem, a protection for all the children of Israel. Okay, so we had anticipation, we have protection. This is what Chumash has to say about that. The word has two meanings in the verse. The first time it refers to God's pledge to Abraham. He reserved the night for the miracle and anticipated its coming throughout the 430 years. Yahweh was looking forward to this thing from the time that he made the pronouncement. 430 years ago, he was anticipating bringing them out. He was on the edge of his seat waiting to make it happen so that he could fulfill a prophecy. Okay? And I think that's the way he is with all of his prophecies. He's anticipating. He's like, will you hurry up, time? You know? Something like that. Okay. The second time the word is used, it refers to the protection from the plague that God extended to the Jews that night. From then on, the first night of Pesach became a time when God protects Israel, according to Rashi. That Rashi's a pretty sharp dude there, Moshiach, now.
You know what it says in here? It uses the same word. It says, much observed, then Shemarim, a night of watching.
A night of watching, anticipation.
Night of watching. Yeah. This old boy that did this here is pretty smart.
Is that Bullinger? Yeah, Bullinger was real sharp. He had a lot on the ball, even if he was a Christian. Okay, are there other questions or comments on these verses? I'm good too. Let's move on then. Verses 43 to the end of the chapter. And Yahweh said unto Moshe and Aharon, this is the ordinance of the Passover. There shall no stranger eat thereof. But every man's servant that is bought for money, when thou hast circumcised him, then shall he eat thereof. A foreigner and an hired servant shall not eat thereof. In one house shall it be eaten. Thou shalt not carry forth aught of the flesh abroad out of the house, neither shall ye break a bone thereof. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. And when a stranger shall sojourn with thee, and will keep the Passover to Yahweh, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as the one that is born in the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof. One law shall be to him that is homeborn, and unto the stranger that sojourneth among you. Thus did all the children of Israel, as Yahweh commanded Moshe and Aharon, so did they. And it came to pass the selfsame day that Yahweh did bring the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their armies. I believe that would be tribes. Questions or comments anywhere there?
If you follow the ordinance of the Passover here, it says no stranger could eat, and it says the servant that was bought, if he was circumcised, later it says the stranger, it says no foreigner except, you see. In other words, when Yeshua died, he died for all that would accept. So there's nobody at all left out. The provisions where they were left out is when they were not obedient. That was the exception. But the except brought them in. And it says that, to me, it says one law pertains to all who would desire to observe the Passover. The law never changed. To the Christians say, well, that was for the Jews. It was for the Jews only. My law doesn't say that in Leviticus. It says these are the feasts of Yahweh. And if we are children of Yahweh, then we are to observe them. If you don't observe them, then you're breaking Torah.
Correct. If you've been grafted into the root, if you have become a member of the Commonwealth of Israel, then that's it. You should be doing everything that Yah tells you to do. But if you do that, you belong to a cult, Liz says, and she's absolutely right. You belong to a cult.
I made mention of,
as far as the government's concerned, it's a cult.
I made mention our niece goes to a high school in our area. She was talking; they were talking about the Passover, and she said that she kept Passover with us. And another young man said, "Well, we had Passover too at our church." And he says, "Well, are you Jewish?" And he goes, "No," he said, "we're Christian, and it's in the Bible, so that's a Christian thing, and we should do it." So I say, God bless him.
Amen. And his family for getting that right in his head. Absolutely. Go ahead, Dan. You got something? Lay it on us, man.
Kind of a question. And let's see, what verse is it? 46. In one house shall be eaten. Thou shalt not carry forth aught of the flesh or broad out of the house. Neither shall you break a bone of it. Now, earlier when I gave instructions for the Passover, they share the meat if one household isn't big enough to suffice for one lamb. But why is it important not to carry it out of the house? What's the significance behind that?
If I may, let me just conjecture here, because and this is coming off the top of my head. Yahweh gave them command to eat that Passover lamb, okay? And none of it was to be left until morning. Any that was left had to be burned, okay? That could be where we're coming from right here, okay? Get in the house, eat the lamb. If there's any left, burn it. None of that flesh is to come out of that house. Okay, and that's the simplest thing I can think of. But why?
Remember the death
angel.
There was a command.
And so why would we ask why? Generally, there are reasons for the commands, but not necessarily always.
Well, part of the reason may be because the death angel was passing over at that time.
He did that night, yes.
Yeah.
And I would assume that all of the firstborn died at pretty much the same time. I don't think that he. I don't think that it was like in the Ten Commandments where you saw the smoke running through the town, you know, and as it reached the house, that was when it happened. I think it all happened at once because they woke up at midnight, and when Pharaoh woke up, everybody was hollering because they had a dead person in the house.
And something we probably should realize that. If the family was small and they couldn't eat the whole lamb, then they doubled up with somebody else, and they were to, from my understanding, was a good number was a minion.
Yeah, a what?
A minion, which was 10.
Ah.
Which is 10, to be in the household to
eat
the lamb.
Okay.
So, if that were true, they would, maybe it was speaking to those people that were in the, that came over to their house to eat, and don't take it out to go back to your house and eat. I don't know.
Right. Well, they were. Well, that could be, but they were not to leave the house.
Yeah. Right.
Until the order came out to go.
Right.
I think that the death angel was kind of it does say it was kind of hovering. Okay. It didn't just. So I think maybe it was waiting for somebody to come out of that house. You know, are you going to obey? I really don't know the reason for it, but that's the truth of it anyway.
Well, what were we talking about today during the? We were talking today, running through the slides. There was something about households and. The Messiah being part of a house, or even when you were saying that when Noah came on the ark, he was righteous and he was ahead of his household. We also made references today back to the Paschal Lamb repeatedly. Is there any connection there in the sense that maybe the one Lamb was to unify a home or unify that body? And that's what the death angel maybe was looking for, other than the doorposts. I don't know.
Yeah, that could very well be. That's excellent conjecture.
This I don't know what he said. This was just telling me that possibly the reason was that they were supposed to be in the safety,
right,
of the blood,
right,
and not
right, right. Good point.
Not to do that, because if we remember correctly, that Yeshua was the one that died outside the camp.
Yeah, let's look at some of the pictures that Eddie gave us in those slides. Okay, yeah, the doorpost represents the circumcised heart. The blood on the doorpost represents Messiah on the circumcised heart. Don't go outside of the door. Okay. Otherwise, you're not under the protection of the Messiah. Your heart is not circumcised. And so that's where the pictures are coming from here.
We had a question. Someone wanted to know, what do you do? They're a vegetarian. Do they have to eat the Passover lamb, take it in and kill it, and a family of four who doesn't have anyone to share the lamb with and doesn't eat meat?
Yes, you find somebody to share a Passover lamb with, and yes, it is a requirement that you eat a little bit of the lamb. You don't have to eat a meal of nothing but lamb. Teresa is a vegetarian, darn near a vegan, okay? But on Pesach, she eats lamb.
A little bit.
If she doesn't, I mean, she doesn't take a big slab of it, but she eats a little bit of lamb because it is a command of Yahweh. That you eat it. I don't care if you're a vegetarian. I don't care what. Yahweh doesn't care. He expects you to obey. Okay? It's that simple. Obey Yahweh. Don't obey you or somebody else. You're supposed to get the leaven out of your house. That's the whole point.
Can I give you a scripture?
Go ahead.
105:28 in Psalms. He, meaning Yahweh, set darkness and made it dark. And it says, and they rebelled not against his word. In other words, the disobedience of this command not to leave the house would have brought you death. Mm-hmm. And sin brings death.
Right. Very good. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be so strident, but it's one of those things that it's just very, very important that you understand that it doesn't matter what we think. What matters is Yahweh has given a command and we are to obey it, regardless of what our personal convictions are about anything. If Yahweh says, you will eat lamb, you will eat lamb, or you will be in sin. It's that simple. We keep the Torah not because it saves us to keep Torah. We keep Torah because Yahweh has given the command. We love him and we want to do what he says, and we don't want to sin. Now, you know, sin is transgression of Torah. So we don't transgress Torah at all. Okay? Other questions or comments?
I would like to point out, it's one of the few times...
Oh, I'm sure you do.
First few times in the Bible where the children of Israel were in all one accord. It says all the children did as they were told. Right? Isn't that what it says? And thus did all the children of Israel.
Even
as
the Arab
Yahweh
Rock.
Commanded. So did they. Period. This is what they did. They did it maybe out of fear, which is all right in a sense. We're supposed to fear him reverently after what they knew was happening in the land, because I'm sure these people all knew what Yahweh was talking about and what Moses had conveyed to the people, that the firstborn, if you didn't obey, this is what was going to happen. And they did obey.
Right. It's important. If in one house shall it be eaten, thou shalt not carry forth aught of the flesh abroad out of the house, neither shall you break a bone thereof. In other words, all of the flesh is to be taken off the carcass, but none of the carcass is to be harmed. Okay? And all the congregation of Israel shall keep it. All the congregation of Israel shall keep it. All means all. Yeah. So, no Israelite is to be left out regardless of his tribe or birth. All Israel means all Israel.
Yes. We have a comment from Miss Watergarden, so you can come to the mic. Watergarden.
Oh, hi, thanks. I hope my mic is working. The thing that when you were talking about why they wouldn't be able to take any of the flesh outside of the house, I was reading some of the rabbis, and I think they make good points on this. If you look at what the children of Israel were told to do as far as bringing a sheep or a lamb or a goat in that's unblemished and how they were to prepare it and all of the commandments that are given in regard to doing this first one are, we'll see later on, that it's like a korban, a burnt offering. Even though that hasn't been given yet, the same exact protocol is there for this first Passover, even applying the blood on the lintels on the door is very similar to what happens later when Moses sprinkles with the blood on the horns and how the tamid offering has to be fully burnt. And so the rabbis actually believe that this first Passover only, that the Egyptian homes that the children of Israel lived in became altars. Their homes were the altars, were the korbanot, is that the right word, the burnt sacrifice, and that's why you wouldn't be bringing that flesh out. But only this first time that they're doing it on the first Passover Exodus, because we're going to see later on over in the second law, Deuteronomy, that when they come into the land, once again, you know, there it has to be done in the house, the temple, the place where God puts his name. So we don't do that here in our homes anymore. I mean, it would be wrong for me to go out and pick a sheep, kill it in my backyard, and apply the blood on the doorpost. In other words, I guess my comment is, I think that there's a progression of protocol as this first Passover, and then when you get over into Deuteronomy, he's giving the second Torah, the second law, and he makes in chapter 16 further protocols before they go into the land. Does anybody agree with me about this? I mean, I don't think we're supposed to be doing this in our backyards now.
I will agree that we are not supposed to be offering a sacrifice in our backyards, because that is only to be done at the temple. I do not necessarily agree that we're not to take one of our own lambs and butcher it if it's butchered properly and use it in the Passover meal. The deal is that we are keeping a memorial of a memorial. Okay, the one-time Passover was the one that we're reading about right here in chapter 12. Anyone that follows after that is a memorial of this. Okay, and so all of that is to look back to this and to look forward to Messiah. Now we can't even do the memorial properly because there's no temple at which to offer the lamb. And there's no command to put the blood on the lintels and the doorpost at any time after this. Okay? That's done one time and one time only. Okay? In the physically it was done in Egypt. Spiritually it's done when we make teshuvah and submit ourselves to Yahweh, to Yeshua. That's the only time that the blood is applied. Okay, so I'll agree with you about the blood. I will not say that it's not okay to do your own Passover lamb. However, it is not a sacrifice. You're butchering it just like you would butcher anything else any other time.
We get in our household.
Yeah. So. Is that okay, Wig? Give me a one if that's okay. Okay, cool. All right, so we agree. Wiggy, a couple of blind squirrels here.
Yeah, she said, please to tell you that I did not mean to have a Passover lamb, just don't call it a sacrifice.
Correct, exactly. It's not a sacrifice. We cannot offer a sacrifice. Not a physical sacrifice. We offer spiritual sacrifices, which is ourselves being offered to Yahweh.
And
a sacrifice of praise, which is a spiritual sacrifice. Okay. Other questions or comments? Yeah, we're all the way through the end of the chapter. Additional laws of the Pesach offering from the Chumash. We get this. This passage, which was given to Moshe on the 14th of Nisan, gives the laws of who must participate in the offering and how they should eat from it. Logically, therefore, it should have come earlier in the chapter, together with the other laws of the Pesach offering. Instead, Torah narrated the sequence of events that took place after the offering was brought. Ramban explains that immediately after Moshe told the nation on the 14th that Elohim was about to break down Pharaoh's resistance, the Torah went on to tell how that happened. With that narrative complete, the Torah returns to the laws of the offering. Okay, I can go with that. So these words that Yahweh gives from verse 43 to 51 were actually told earlier in the narrative, but they wanted the narrative to go flow. Moshe wanted the narrative to flow freely. Okay. Makes sense. There's this comment in the Chumash about the in one house. The requirements of this verse demonstrate the regal nature of the Pesach feast. Kings and aristocrats do not rush from feast to feast, nor do they break bones in order to get at the hidden bit of meat or marrow. So in one house means don't run back and forth looking to have. Oh, let's see what the Smiths are having tonight for Pesach. Let's go over and see what the Joneses are having. Let's go see the Millers. Oh, let's not go to Patron's. They're filthy. You know.
I think one of the lessons here, Moses was considered a prophet.
He was?
He was given the word by Yahweh. He spoke the word to the people, and Yahweh made sure that it came to pass. So in being a prophet, and in the prophets that we have throughout the word, doesn't make them higher than anybody else. It just makes them a servant that Yahweh used. And we have to keep that in mind. Were these people awed? Pharaoh was very much awed of Moses, or he would have had he and Aaron killed before that. But he knew, you see, and he knew. He basically knew is because who was in charge of Moses and Aaron, that Yahweh, a greater power, was. And so these things that we're discussing here were already given back in earlier chapters in the Genesis book. Some of these things were given. So to say that Moses was a prophet is true, but only a prophet indeed when Yahweh fulfills what he had already given him. So we know a true prophet is one who says, "Thus saith Yahweh," and that comes true.
Is this the same Pharaoh that raised Moshe?
Sorry?
Is this the same Pharaoh that raised Moshe?
Raised him? No. That Pharaoh died long ago. Okay, this could very well be one who had conquered Egypt from outside. After all, they knew not. I'm sorry? He was an Assyrian according to Josephus.
According to Josephus, he was an Assyrian. There were other conquerors as Nebuchadnezzar's group came down.
Right.
But at this period of time, there were two. One was an Assyrian, and I can't recall what the other one. It was a split nation. You had upper Egypt and lower Egypt.
Right.
My understanding. So there was warring factions there. So when one became weak, the other took them over. It was like a back and forth type deal at times. So this one, it says that who knew not Joseph.
Right.
Well, I'll tell you what. If this person would have been an Egyptian, he'd have known who Joseph was.
Right.
Because he was very much esteemed. This guy coming in Assyrian, he don't know anything about Moses and what he did.
Right. In the meanwhile, we know that the Pharaoh that raised Moses was one of these conquerors. He was not an Egyptian. Okay. Yeah. I don't believe this is the same guy. We're talking 80 years. The Pharaoh that raised Moses was already an adult by the time he started raising Moshe. So I don't have chapter and verse to prove this, but I don't believe that it's the same guy. I believe it's his son or maybe his son's son. Are there any other questions or comments on the Torah portion for today? Anyone in Pal Talk have a question or a comment? Then let us move on to our really, really big Haftarah portion. I'll read it for you. The burden of Dumah. He called me out of Seir. Watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? We're doing a great big long Selah here because that's the end of the Haftarah.
I do have some, I think.
Go for it, man.
Talking about the burden of Edom being called out. When it says, what of the night? Now, this verse could well relate to Israel's escape from Egypt by night. In their flight, as Egypt's army was really overtaking them, did they cry as in Job it's a 35:10. Where is Yahweh, my Maker, who gives songs in the night? Now, as Edom was soon to be reduced to silence or destruction, so was Egypt in their day. But because even the innocent suffered, not by humbling themselves to seek Yah's and seek Yah, fear overtakes them, and they hear not the songs of the night, or as in their calamity. And you know what? People today have the same problem. Church today has the same problem. They don't have that song in the night. And this is one of the, this is to me is one of our warnings here, that when this time comes, well, are we going to say the same thing? What of the night? What of the night? Where is my Maker? If we sing the songs in the night, then we'll be ready when the daybreak comes. That's a guarantee. And He will watch over us as He watched over the children of Israel.
I don't have anything on Isaiah chapter 21 and verse 11. I could jump in on like a Matthew Henry commentary or something like that, but I think that's all we're going to have on the, unless there's a question or comment out there in Pal Talk land. I'll tell you, what is a watchman? What of the night? Watchman, what of the night? A watchman has basically two duties. Number one, in wartime, he's to watch for any enemy action coming against the camp. And in peacetime, he's to watch for any enemy action coming against the camp. He's to warn people of what's coming. Okay? The watchman is to make sure that everybody is safe when he's in time of peace, and he's to make sure that everybody's safe when it's time of war. That's his job. So, watchman, what of the night? I need to look at the context of this thing to get an idea.
Duma means silent, I believe.
Duma means what?
According to what I looked up, it meant silence. And they was Egypt silence?
Oh, yeah. From an unused root, yeah, meaning to be dumb.
Yeah.
Silent.
Yep.
Figuratively, yep. Death.
Mm-hmm.
The burden of silence.
Yeah.
He calleth unto me out of Seir. Watchman, what of the night? What of the night? The watchman said, the morning cometh, and also the night. If we will inquire, inquire ye. Return, come.
Isn't that strange that this is the sixth burden that was mentioned?
Is that right?
Portraying to man, yeah.
Huh. He calleth me out of Seir. Seir is, isn't that Edom?
It is. It, according to the Bollinger here, it says it's Duma equals Edom. It's the abbreviated form of the fuller name of Edomine. As it gives 34:5, Ezekiel 35:16, and 36:8, and so forth. So it says Duma, silent, prophetic, meaning of its end, that they would be, it would be silent, and those who sleep in the grave are silent.
Very good. So basically, this is a sleeping watchman. Oh yeah. He calleth me out of Seir. Watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? Hey, wake up, man.
What did Yeshua say,
watchman,
in the garden?
Wake up.
What did Yeshua say in the garden?
Can't you watch with me for 1 hour?
That's it. That was the hour that he needed them to watch.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
Interesting. The morning come. The watchman said, the morning cometh, and also the night. If you will inquire, inquire ye. Return, come. Wow. Okay.
Water Garden says that it reminds her of the 10 virgins, too.
Yes. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay. No other questions or comments? We shall move to Psalm 49. Let me get there here in the computer. Everything's done with the computer these days. Psalm 49. Hear this, all ye people. Give ear, all ye inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak of wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall be of understanding. I will incline mine ear to a parable. I will open my dark saying upon the harp. Therefore, wherefore should I fear in the days of evil, when the iniquity of my heel shall compass me about? They that trust in their wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to Elohim a ransom for him. For the redemption of their soul is precious, and it ceaseth forever. That he should still live forever, and not see corruption. For he seeth that wise men die, likewise the fool and the brutish person perish, and leave their wealth to others. Their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever, and their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. Nevertheless, man being in honor abideth not. He is like the beasts that perish. This their way is their folly, yet their posterity approve their sayings. Selah. Stop and think about that. So stop for a minute and think about that. Their posterity approve their sayings. Their way is their folly. Stop and think about that. Their way is obviously not the way of Yahweh. Their posterity approve their sayings, which means that they've raised them up in the way that they would have their children to go, not in the way that Yahweh would have them go. Okay. In verse 4, we see a parable and a dark saying. Parable is a dark saying. That's a definition. The scripture has a funny way of doing that, defining itself within a verse or two when it uses a different word, you know, like parable. You know, it defines what a parable is right very shortly afterwards. It's a dark saying. Dark saying doesn't mean that it's evil or something. It's just that it's a mystery being told. A parable is usually metaphoric, okay? So it's not saying exactly what something is, but it's giving you an idea of what it is. So a parable is always a remez.
One thing laid by another.
Right. A parable is always a remez. It's a hint of the truth. Okay? So that's what we're seeing here. It's a dark saying. It's something that they're not saying it right out, but they're giving you a hint. Questions or comments anywhere in the psalm?
The psalm in a nutshell, but there's a lot in here, deals with the need of redemption is realized. It teaches that earthly advantages are not reliable for permanent happiness, and however prosperous worldly men may be for a time, their ultimate destiny is ruin, while the pious are safe in Yahweh's care. Now, how do we take this psalm, and how do we relate this to the end time that's coming? Now, we look around us and we see the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, and like everything that we own and hold precious to our freedoms and everything are slowly and sometimes rapidly being taken with us. And some of these people are very fear, and I mean very fearful, and a lot of them are Christian people. What is happening? What is going on? What's going on is what the Word says is going on and what's going to happen. If you understand Torah,
then you understand the concept that Eddie told me years and years and years ago. It's here now, but not yet. The concept of what takes place with these people and the times that they were in and the conditions that they were in are coming to pass, not just because Yahweh said it, because of the sin of the people. It says, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. How bad was it back then? It was pretty bad. Is it bad now? Yeah, but it's going to get worse. It's going to get worse. And we are going to see, quote, that darkness. And there's always a saying, this darkest, it's always the darkest before the dawn. And if that holds true, then we are going to see the light at the darkest point. Then the light will shine forth. And he's basically, this is what he's telling them here, that wherefore should I fear in the days of evil, when the iniquity of my heel shall compass about me? He's talking about these supplanters, and that's what they're doing. They're basically supplanting everything that's been in our Constitution we hold dear. Everything we hold dear as a family. It doesn't really matter about family anymore. You know, you have two women living together, two men living together. Is it right? No, it's not right. It's wrong. So we have these conditions. And these people, it's going to be folly to them. And only what the Word says, if we hold true to the Word, the best of our ability, is going to mean anything at all. And basically this, I believe, is what it's talking about here.
Okay, so you were talking about darkness. We're heading into the dark time. And light will come, okay? And we know that. Which brought to mind our five-minute update that we do every week, looking at the news of the last week and as it refers to Bible prophecy. It's the reason that we do this is because we know that we're headed into the darkness and we need to be able to see the light at the end of the tunnel. Okay? And that's what we're trying to do with this five-minute update, is to give us an idea. We're looking for the light at the end of the tunnel. It's to give us a hope, because we know that that light is down there, and we're moving towards it, rapidly moving towards it, but we got darkness to go through before we get there.
You know, he tells him here at the end of the of this psalm, he shall go to the generations of his fathers, they shall never see light. That pretty much sums it up. And it says, man that is in honor and understanding not is like the beast that perishes, is in folly. You see, if you have knowledge, and the idea of knowledge is great, but if you don't apply it, it's wrong, it's bad. We've had people that had come into our group over the years, and they said, well, we want to learn about all this stuff, but we don't want to do. And guess what today? Both of them are miserable shape. They've been in hospital and out of hospital. They've had operations. And they're divorced. This was their statement that they made in our house. Very foolish. Their lives have come to folly. Because they did not. They want to learn it, but they don't want to do it. Why learn it if you don't want to do it? What good does it do? It's folly.
Okay. Verses 6 through 10. Interesting. I have some interesting comments for this. They that trust in their wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches. Comment on that is, all the money in the world can't redeem our soul, nor will it be a ransom for anyone else. All the money in the world can't do it. None of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him. No mere man can pay the ransom for his own soul, much less redeem someone else. Only Yahweh can effect the ransom as a kinsman redeemer. For the redemption of their soul is precious, and it ceaseth forever. And it was a one-time deal. Yahweh made one provision by himself on the tree in the person of Yeshua, Yahweh Yeshua HaMashiach, that he will live, that he should live forever and not see corruption. Boy, who was that? Can't be anybody but Yeshua HaMashiach. For he seeth that wise men die, likewise a fool and the brutish person perish and leave their wealth to others. They say, I've made so much money that my posterity will never hunger forever. He just creates I can't read that either. He just creates more people who trust in their wealth. That's all he does. Okay, and in this case, they're trusting in the wealth that somebody else earned. And they're not going to have the same kind of regard for it as the guy that actually earned it. And therefore, they're not going to care for it. And they'll end up being poor, even though they started out very rich. Their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever and their dwelling places to all generations. They call their land after their own names. They think, like in America, they think, I'll be famous. Well, then, yeah, go ahead. Break my computer. Go ahead. just giving you a hard time. are there any other questions or comments?
I would like to make a mention about the riches of men.
Yeah, well, you can't. Sorry.
I'm going to come over there and bop you this time. My understanding is that John D. Rockefeller was one of the richest men in the world in his time of life. But you know what? He couldn't eat food like we did. He had to basically eat baby food because of his insides and everything. His comment was, I would give up all the riches that I have to be able to eat normally. So those riches, what did they get him? He was a sick man. He was an ill man that could not function like we would do and just eat the pleasures of food that we enjoy. So those riches didn't do hoot for him.
Heard that.
You have something, Daniel?
Can make comment and question kind of tied up into one. This psalm doesn't really directly... Well, I can't see anything that directly relates to our Torah portion. It's just the overall principles of the psalm of that the only redemption that we're going to find is through Yeshua HaMashiach, and it just kind of shows exile and redemption. The exile you can experience by having riches, and the redemption of experiencing Yeshua. But I guess my question is: is there anything in this psalm that does relate to our directly to our Torah portion?
Of course, there is. I don't know what it is right offhand either, unless maybe it's the next verse.
My,
like sheep, they are laid in the grave. Death shall feed on them, and the upright shall have dominion over them in the morning, and their beauty shall consume in the grave from their dwelling. Like sheep, there's. You could make the stretch there. But yes, God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, for mm-hmm. he shall receive me.
Yeah.
Selah, that's the next portion right there, those two verses. Like sheep they are laid in the grave in the morning, not in the evening, okay? And the upright shall have dominion over them in the morning, not in the evening, which is the time of that the wicked dominate. Evening precedes morning. Evil dominates for a time, then the righteous rule by Yahweh's power.
Right.
In the evening is when Israel, or the death angel went through Egypt. In the morning is when Israel left Egypt. Okay, so they came out of the bondage. They were redeemed from the bondage in the evening, in the darkness, and they were delivered from it in the morning. I think maybe that might be our connection.
The other thought we have in verse 1 and 2, it says, this was for all to hear. And 3 and 4, it says, I will speak. First you listen, then I will speak. I think the theme here is like an enigma. And the solution is the incarnation and the work of the Redeemer. It's only the work of the Redeemer that could bring us forth into the light. Talks about the light. And who sees the light? Those that are redeemed. Those are the redeemed. Yeshua is the Redeemer. Was he the light in the Exodus? Yeah, he was. He was the light in the Exodus. So these Psalms, who's ever done it, has lined up these Psalms to correlate with all the Psalms correlate with the Torah, the first five books. They're supposed to go hand in hand. And they pretty much do. You just have to dig in and to study it and to see. But it's all there. Even though some of this stuff happened to some of these people at that time, it's also another happening that's going to happen. And we can take the Psalms and entrust them into our lives to say, well, you know what? This is what's happened to me. And then there's always that light that's at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. It's no different than Proverbs. My suggestion to young couples before they get married to sit down and read the book of Proverbs together, because that's where life's at. The whole life cycle and everything for mankind to learn is in the book of Proverbs. Can't go wrong by reading the Word. And that's what he said. You listen, and I'll speak. Sometimes we sort of get it backwards, you know what I mean?
Yeah, just looking at the painful reality of verse 7, it says, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give God a ransom for him. That speaks the truth to me, like, just directly. Is I know I have loved ones that, you know, aren't following, you know, Yeshua. And I would so love to see them saved. But it is kind of nice. It says, no God, in God, or you cannot put a ransom for him. It does show the value of life. It's nice. It's your life is a lot worth more than just the payment. It's something that you have to live holy for. So.
That's good. Yeah, in the morning. Interesting. Other questions or comments? Up to verse 15. Up to verse 15. We'll move on to verses 16 through 20. Be not thou afraid when one is made rich, when the glory of his house is increased. For when he dieth, he shall carry nothing away. His glory shall not descend after him. Notice, his glory shall not descend after him. Doesn't say that it won't ascend after him. It will not descend after him. Though while he lived, he blessed his soul, and men will praise thee when thou doest well to thyself. And men will praise thee when thou doest well to thyself. He shall go to the generation of his fathers. They shall never see light. Man that is in honor and understandeth not is like the beasts that perish. Man that is in honor and understandeth not. Okay? Here's a man who men honor. But he has no understanding of truth, of Torah. And therefore, when he dies, he's just like a beast that dies. Oh, this is some pretty heavy stuff here. Don't listen. This is a marked paraphrase of verses 15 through 20. Don't listen to the prosperity gospel. Riches are no proof of God's favor on your life and lifestyle. Fear God and honor the king. The richest man in the world takes nothing with him in death. If he fails to understand the grace and mercy of Yah, he is like a beast in his death, no hope of life eternal. So, that's a marked paraphrase. I think it's a pretty good one. I could be wrong.
You just doubt it.
But I doubt it. I'm sorry?
But you just doubt it. But you're wrong.
Never. I could be wrong, but I doubt it.
We have a comment from Water Garden. I had my screen scrolled down, so I don't know yet. It's not getting tired being up that long. So I will let you come to the mic and so you can rest your hands. Water Garden.
Hey, thanks. I have a little book on Psalms, and one of the interesting things about this psalm is that the rabbis are pointing out the fact that this is a song that was written by the sons of Korah. And, of course, this is a little midrash that they do, but they also say that they think that Korah amassed a lot of wealth and riches in somehow in Egypt. And if you look at verse 13, I just thought it was interesting that the sons of Korah are actually speaking of a man who is trusting in his wealth and his riches, and yet whose ways and speech are foolish. In other words, he was usurping or wanted to maybe the job of Aaron or Moshe, and then he had others who approved of his words, like in verse 13 it says, and of those after them who approve their words, as sheep they are appointed to Sheol, death shall be their shepherds. And the earth actually swallowed Korah and the men that were listening to him up. And I just thought it was so interesting that it's actually his descendants who are singing a song that I think in many ways has a lesson for us not to follow the way of Korah, but also they are like living examples of the mercy of Hashem, because these are his descendants who are actually singing this.
That's very interesting. That's what book is that that you're talking about there, Wiggy?
I mentioned it before. It's put out by Masorah Publications, Art Scroll Tanakh series. It's all the Psalms, Mark. It's five books. And it's a Midrash, a new translation with a commentary from Talmudic, Midrashic, and Rabbinic sources. And it's very good, helpful with these Psalms.
Thank you. So that's the Art Scroll Tehillim. Is that correct? Just give me a one. Okay, good. All right, the Art Scroll Tehillim from Masorah Publications. Cool. I'll look into that. Other questions or comments?
In relation to this psalm, if we go back to Psalm 37, it says, "Fret not thyself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against the workers of iniquity, for they shall soon be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herb." But he says, "Trust in Yahweh and do good, so shall thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. Delight thyself also in Yahweh, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart." So if we look to him, to his word, and he tells us here and say, be not thou afraid when one is made rich. Don't worry about that. Saying, well, why was he given all the riches? You know, the riches of the world mean nothing. If you don't believe it, go to some of the tombs of the pharaohs and see if they took anything with them or not. Mark.
Ooh. Pick me.
Okay, Mark.
Okay. I wanted to say this before, and I slipped my mind. Rabbis have this cool little teaching. Ramchal, Chaim Luzzatto, has this to say. Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, who's a really good Orthodox teacher from like the 16th century or something like that. Anyway, he says that the rich people, he says that everyone gets rewards for the evil and the good that they do in their life. Okay? The reason that you see rich people living in luxury and seeming to just flaunt their riches and thumb their nose at Yahweh is because even those people that have absolutely nothing, want nothing to do with Yahweh, still do positive mitzvot in their lives. Okay? And they need to be rewarded for that. And the only time that Yahweh has to reward them for the good deeds that they do in their lives is during their lifetime. And therefore, they seem to be rich and they seem to have all this stuff, and they have no eternity in which to be rewarded. They have eternity in which to be punished for their evil deeds. Meanwhile, we see people who are following after Yahweh and have nothing physically. They're poor. They'll never be rich physically. But they have eternity in which to be rewarded for all the good deeds that they do. And they have only this life in order to be punished for the evil that they do. And so they get to be punished in this life, but they have eternity to look forward to with Yahweh and to gain the rewards for all the good that they do. Okay? So I think that's where we're coming from with this chapter. Okay? We're told, you know, yeah, we're the poor people, you know, Yeshua says you have the poor you have with you always and all that. We're talking about poor people at the beginning of the thing, and then the end of the rich, which is they die like beasts. You know? So I think that's a tie-in to what Bill was just saying. Are there any other questions or comments? If there are not, I'll chew up what I have of my popcorn in my mouth right now while turning to Revelation chapter 18.
We didn't even offer them any. Anybody out there want some popcorn?
You're out of luck because you're going to have to come here to get it. Chapter 18. Let's see. There is no chapter break anywhere in here, so there are 24 verses. We're going to do the first 8. Okay. And after these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power. After what things? Why, the things of chapter 17, of course. And what things do we have in chapter 17 but mystery Babylon, religious Babylon? Making war with the saints, being drunk on their blood, that kind of stuff. Okay. So now we're at chapter 18. And after these things, I saw another angel come down from heaven, having great power. And the earth was lightened with his glory. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become the habitation of devils, and the hold of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. And I heard another voice from heaven, saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye may not be partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Reward her even as she rewarded you, and double unto her double according to her works. In the cup which she hath filled, fill to her double. In the cup which she hath filled, fill to her double. Now, before I read the next two verses, let me just... I think there's a definite parallel right here in chapter 18 with the mother of harlots in chapter 17. And I think it's direct. So it's the same Babylon. It's just that the Babylon in 17 is obviously ecclesiastical or religious, while the 18 is obviously economic. But she's the same in Babylon. And I think is fallen is talking about both the economic and the religious Babylon being fallen. Okay? Okay, back to the verses. Chapter 7, or verse 7. How much she had glorified herself and lived deliciously, so much torment and sorrow give her. For she saith in her heart, I sit a queen, and am no widow, and shall see no sorrow. Therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is Yahweh Elohim who judgeth her. That was, we've done chapter 18 through verse 8. The light emanating from this angel in verse 1 pierces the darkness of the sixth vial. Only one kind of light can do that. Remember, the sixth vial was poured out in, let's see, where is it? In verse, and the sixth angel, verse 12 of 16, poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up. Three unclean spirits. Blessed is he that watcheth and keepeth his garments. Did I read that wrong? I just referenced it wrong. There was a great darkness that people could feel. Darn, I can't find it now. Ah, there it is in chapter 8, or verse 8 rather. And the fourth angel poured out his vial upon the sun, and the power was given unto him to scorch men. And we're scorched, that's not it either. Oh, 10. And his kingdom was full of darkness, and they gnawed their tongues for pain, and blasphemed the God of heaven because of their pains and their sores, and repented not of their deeds. So that's part of the fourth vial being poured out. The darkness comes upon the earth, so that that's what he's talking about there in verse 8. This angel comes through there, and he actually pierces that darkness with his presence. This has got to be either one great created angel, or it's got to be Yahweh himself.
The only other time I see the light like this here, outside of what's at the end of Revelation, is the fact of what happened in Genesis chapter 1. That first light that was illuminated was Yeshua. And I just have to believe if it's this kind of a light, it has great power. And it says, and the earth was lightened with his glory, and he had a mighty and strong voice. How can it be anything but Yeshua? I don't see how it can be. That's what I believe anyhow. I think it's in verse 2, it says that he is fallen. Okay, 14:8. If you look there, Isaiah 21:9, Jeremiah 51:8, this is dealing, like Mark had said, with the second falling. It's the second half of this, one religious and the other economic. And I believe that's why you see two fallings, because it says double for double. And I believe that's what I get out of it. And it alludes to a future calling in that day. Verse 4 says, And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye have not partake of her sins, ye receive not of her plagues. Now, he's talking about his people here. Does that mean that some of his people have partaken? I believe so. I believe that they've taken the fornication, they've done the things that they weren't told to do. Basically, because they haven't followed Torah. Because he says in verse 3, for all nations have drunken of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. If we take the word literally, I think the all means all. And he says, when he says my people, he tells them, don't be a part of this judgment. This is a warning. This is a warning he gives. Because in earlier chapters that Mark was alluding to, I think chapter 8 that you alluded to?
It was chapter 16 and verse 8.
Okay. If you look up there, you'll see he says, I come as a thief in the night. Be watchful. There's part of the connection with the other song as the watchman, to be watchful. We are to be watchful of this thing that's coming upon them. The greatness, I think, says the greatness of their sins has reached into heaven. That's how great the sin was that was done. To me, this is the apostate Christendom, because the only ones that could give a voice into heaven would be those who were children of his, that he would hear. And what he's hearing here is not good. This is bad. This is really bad. And it says that the taste of her wines will turn sour in judgment. This finery that they have will be trodden down. And it says, and it will be double for double. For she is waxed wanton. If you look in 1 Timothy 5, verses 11 and 12, it deals with that. And she, again, does the same thing that some of those people were doing. It says she gives glory to herself and not to Yahweh. To me, it's the church and these people are on, or and the Babylon here is on an ego trip. In other words, they're saying, I am somebody. Look at me. And I'm a self-made man. I've done all this stuff. And she brags as herself as a queen, right? Mm-hmm. As the queen of heaven. So she's trying to be this person. And then he says here, for this cause, in one day will come death, mourning, famine, and a burn with fire by Yahweh Elohim, the judge. He's going to take care of this problem. That's what I have there.
Okay, Babylon the Great is fallen, verse 2. First thing that comes to mind when I read is fallen, is the World Trade Center coming down. Boom, boom. Okay. Is become the habitation of devils. Is become means that this Babylon was not Babylon all the time. Okay? It is become the habitation of devils. This is a late development. Okay? It was not founded as the habitation of devils. Okay? And the hold of every foul spirit and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. The cage of every unclean and hateful bird. You're going to see... I'm seeing a lot more anyway this year than I have in previous years. Turkey vultures. Whole bunches of them. Lots and lots and lots of them. I mean... There used to be a lot of them, but I mean not like now. I'm seeing flocks of 30 and 40 of them at a time. Together, yeah. I mean, that's pretty amazing. I think Yahweh's getting ready to he's gonna bring all the carrion birds to eat the flesh of the men that are destroyed. Yeah. So anyway, for all nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, talking about Babylon the Great, okay? And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. I'm telling you, this sounds like none other than the United States of America. Okay? At least at this time. Should this be fulfilled any time in the next few years, it's talking about us. Okay? Babylon of commerce. Do you think it could be New York City? Look at Isaiah 25:3. Let me look there real quick, like. Jeremiah, Isaiah, 37, 30, 28.
Hey, while you're looking, someone wants to know what a turkey vulture is.
Turkey vulture is a carrion bird of the Midwest in the summertime. In the wintertime, they'll go to the shore over in Virginia, places like that. It's about a 5-foot wingspan, 4 to 5 foot wingspan, and they eat carrion. They clean up the land. I mean, they're given to us by Yahweh to clean up all the death that happens around. Okay, and there are lots and lots of them. Oh, by the way, the deer are incredible. I saw a herd of 30 deer the other day.
What do deer do?
Deer feed the carrion. they become the carrion. They feed the. There's so many of them. They're getting hit left and right on the roads too.
Do they sail on hot air currents?
But anyway, 25:3, in reference to Babylon the Great is fallen. Okay? Therefore shall the strong people glorify thee, the city of the terrible nation shall fear thee. Boy, sounds a little bit like what we saw in New York City. Zion, spiritual strength. one city, many nations. UN headquarters in New York City, Rome, D.C., all three maybe? I don't know, but it looks like Revelation 18 to me. Is become, let's say, perhaps refers to the World Trade Center. New Age Monument can be the second half of this verse. Is become the habitation of devils and the hold of every foul spirit and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. They're going to build that 1,776-foot high tower where the World Trade Center used to be. And I forget what they're going to call that thing. The Freedom Tower or something like that. Or,
well, they're Freedom Pride. That's what's important.
Yeah. So, anyway, they're going to build this thing and it's going to look twisted and all that. I mean, it's really going to look like something out of Satan's mind. 1776 is the year the Illuminati was founded. There are all kinds of esoteric references in the plans of this thing, the height of it, the size of it on the ground. Everything has to do there's Masonic symbology, all of that. So it's a lot of wickedness. This is being built on the site of the World Trade Center, or is going to be built on the site of the World Trade Center.
Yeah, I know someone who was born on the birthday of the Illuminati, too.
When Revelation 18 is referring to Babylon, the way it's worded, or what are you guys' opinion, and people in Pal Talk too, is this specifically a physical place, or is this both going to be a physical place or physical places and spiritual places or a spiritual idea? I mean, is it both, or is it specifically one and specifically one, or is it both?
Yes. In verse 4, yeah. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, be ye not partakers of her sins, that ye receive not her plagues. Yahweh is speaking, okay, because it says, come out of her, my people, okay. Whose people are they? It's got to be, okay. That ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. Will they obey? Can they hear? I mean, he says this aloud so that they can hear his voice. Will they obey? I'm going to tell you something, they better. Verse 6, Yahweh himself prophesies all the way to verse 16 here. Tense change signals a change of point of view. John writes in the past tense throughout the book of which he witnesses. All from here to verse 16 is in the future tense. Okay, so tense change is a change of voice. Now, it says, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her plagues, and that ye receive not her plagues. In verse, look at Zechariah chapter 2 and verse 7, where it says, deliver thyself, O Zion, that dwelleth with the daughter of Babylon. Deliver thyself, O Zion, that dwelleth with the daughter of Babylon. What it's saying is, get out of her, my people. Yeah. When this plague starts coming, down, these people, Yahweh is going to say, you want out of there, you're going to have to do it yourself. I've given you the warning. I've given you the warnings for months and years. You should have been ready to be out of here. You should have been out of here long ago. Why are you still there? Okay? Now you want deliverance. I've provided you all the deliverance that there is. It reminds me kind of the joke, you know, where the guy falls in the water and, you know, the river is carrying him downstream, and a guy on the shore within throwing distance says, hey man, I got a lifeline. You want it? And the guy says, no, I'm waiting for God to deliver me. I've prayed to God, and he's going to deliver me. Okay? And then another guy is in a boat, and he's floating along, and the boat comes right up alongside the guy, and he says, hey, you want a hand? I can get you out of there if you'd like. And the guy says, no. I have prayed to God, and I've asked him to deliver me, and he'll deliver me. And the next, you know, he goes on a little bit further, and he's almost at the verge of drowning, and he realizes, you know, God always delivers at the last possible moment, you know. And a helicopter flies overhead, and he sees the guy's problem, and the helicopter, you know, he gets on the PA system, and he hollers at the guy, hey, I'll throw you a line. You want to? You know, I'll get you out of there. And the guy says, no, I'm waiting for God to deliver me. I've prayed to God, and He's going to deliver me. And the next thing the guy knows, he's dead, and he's standing before God. And he says, I don't understand. I prayed to you to deliver me. And God said, I sent the guy with the rope. I sent the guy with the boat. I sent you a helicopter. How many times do you want me to deliver you? You know what? At that point, it's on you, man. And I think that's exactly where they're at here in Revelation chapter 18. I've tried to deliver you, and you haven't listened. Now you get to deliver yourself.
A question from Water Garden. In verse 18, the first verse, she said, and her question is, the verse is, that after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, the earth which was lit up by his splendor. The question is, whose authority is so great it illuminates the earth with his glory? Who is it, and what angel has glory like this?
Anyone Yahweh wants to give it to. I'm serious. Anyone that Yahweh wants to give it to. That's really it's not just a joke. Angels have been known to do exactly this, just give off light. Maybe that was the angel of Yahweh. Maybe it was an angel from Yahweh. Okay? I mean, Yahweh can do this in any way that he pleases. So I really can't answer that question, who this angel was. Could very well be that it's Yahweh himself. But it could also be that it's an angel that Yahweh has specifically given this power to and given this authority to. The fact that this particular guy cried mightily with a strong voice, this is John telling what it may be the same angel that we're talking about in verses 4 and following, but I don't know. It could very well be that it's the angel of Yahweh. Don't know the answer to that. Sorry, Wiggy. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I don't have that answer. Probably your own idea is as good as mine anyway.
She just said, an angel with great authority that would light up the earth, and won't that be something to behold?
Absolutely, that'll be something to behold. What exactly is your idea? Do you think maybe it's just an angel, or do you think that it's a created angel, or do you think it's the angel of Yahweh himself? Give me a poll. I want a poll.
Okay.
All right, I want... Okay. Those of you who think it's an angel of Yahweh himself, I want a one. Give me a one.
How many
ones am I getting?
Ones for if it's an angel of Yah.
The angel of Yah.
The angel of Yah. Okay, we got two, and one of them is Miss Water Garden.
Okay, and now, an angel from Yah. Give me a two.
We got about four ones. Four twos, although one of them is from Water Garden.
So Wiggy sees it the way I do. Could be either.
Okay, so we've got two, four, five twos.
Okay. Great. You know what, guys? You're all right. No matter how you look at it, it's the power of Yah. coming either through Yahweh himself or through an angel that he sent. So, effectively, it's Yah.
You need to put a poll up on fulfillingtorah.org.
Right now, I've got to have a good working foo box, and I don't have one right now to do that. So I'm not able to add things to Fulfilling Torah right now. Maybe I'll go to karm.org, I think is the name of the thing. Christian Apologetics and Research Ministry. Okay? They have a discussion forum, and one of the discussion forums is for Messianic Jews. And maybe I'll put a poll up on that and see what happens.
So you think that this is the Messiah hidden?
Could be. Could be just an angel using Messiah's, exercising Yahweh's glory. Whatever, it all comes down to him, and he eventually, that's where the power comes from. Okay. Therefore shall, in verse 8, therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire, for strong is Yahweh Elohim who judgeth her. This sounds like coordinated nuclear attacks in the United States of America. Not necessarily missile attacks, but could very well be a bunch of terrorists getting together and setting off nukes in various cities. But it sounds like a coordinated thing because it all happens in one day. Large populations destroyed by nukes, vast areas of farmland wiped out by bio and nuke attack. Could very well be. And by the way, there's a book on the market. What is the name of that thing? Bill? We were talking about the book that the author was on.
Johnson, I just gave it to you too.
Yeah.
Dead Heat.
Dead Heat. That's the name of the movie. Or the book, rather. On the market now. It's a Christian writer who is putting out possibilities of how the stuff will come down in the end, and it's chilling because he uses today's headlines or recent headlines to build his story around, and it's incredible. It's been likened to what do you call it? The Tim LaHaye series. The Left Behind series, except it's truer to what's going on in the world. It is a book right now. Dead Heat. Joel Rosenberg, that's the guy's name. Joel Rosenberg is the author. Okay. They haven't made a movie out of it yet. It might be real life, and we might see it in the very near future. That's what
all the other books happen that way.
Yeah, this is the fifth book in a series of five books, and all the other books have been very prophetic, and every one of them has happened the way he laid it out. It's pretty incredible.
And these books, I mean, are planned out months in advance. It's not like it can. Some of them have happened within days of the book coming out.
Yeah, right. The whole thing is that this guy looks at what's happened in the news, what's really happened in the world, and then he applies that to what's happening in scripture. Very similar to the way that Eddie does that, and he's been on the money. So probably not a prophet. No, he tells you he's not a prophet. He's just reading the scripture, reading the news, and putting the two together and connecting the dots. Okay.
That
makes a fictional story out of it that turns out to be true.
Yeah, I saw an interview. He said, you know, if he were just to write what he thinks about what the Bible says about prophecy, people would say he's nuts and wouldn't buy the book, but if he puts it in a fictional setting and does the same thing,
right,
it does well.
Right, and in the meanwhile, it all happens, and people go, wow, this guy's really prescient, isn't he? Okay, any other questions or comments? Up to verse 8. Okay, then let's move on. Verse 9 through 16. And the kings of the earth who have committed fornication and lived deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament for her when they shall see the smoke of her burning, standing afar off for the fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, the great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in one day is thy judgment come. Oh, man. The kings of the earth are standing afar off for the fear of her torment. Let me tell you something. There's nukes going off, and they're afraid of what's of getting anywhere close to it because they're going to die from radiation poisoning. And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buyeth their merchandise any more. The merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones, and of pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and all fine wood, and all manner vessels of ivory, and all manner vessels of most precious wood, and of brass and marble and iron, and cinnamon and odors and ointments and frankincense and wine and oil and fine flour and wheat and beasts and sheep and horses and chariots and slaves and the souls of men. And the fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee, and all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from thee, and thou shalt find them no more at all. The merchants of these things which were made rich by her shall stand afar off for the fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls. Okay, Yahweh was prophesying all the way to here, to verse 16. In verse 10, alas, alas, 9/11 in the World Trade Center, a foreshadowing of things to come for the USA. 9/11 in the World Trade Center. The World Trade Center was at least a symbol of Babylon the Great, from verse 2. And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her. The U.S. essentially given up. Has essentially given up all manufacturing and just buys from foreign sources. The world's largest economy feeds all the others. When the U.S. is gone, they all starve. 28 types of merchandise, 4 sets of 7, like the judgments on the earth, 4 sets of 7. Remember, the seals are opened, then the trumpets are blown. The seventh trumpet brings the 7 thunders that we're not told about, and the 7th thunder brings the 7 vials. Okay? 4 different sets of 7 judgments. Okay? We have 4 sets of 7 pieces of merchandise sold through commercial Babylon. Okay, that's all I got. Questions or comments?
Okay, we have several... several thoughts, so let me try and piece them together and into some of the different thoughts. So, a few of the questions: are we saying that Babylon the Great is USA, the same Babylon as Revelation 17, and also how does America fit verse 24? And verse, people are saying that they saw it more as Rome or Vatican City. So those are some things you can comment on.
When I'm saying that the United States is Babylon, okay, I'm not saying that it's the only thing that will fit the scenario. Okay? I think that this fits the United States very well, from at least through the first 16 verses. It fits us very well. Now, there may be other verses that apply specifically to somebody else, but I think that we could probably make the case that the United States fits all of this as well, all of this chapter. After all, let's think about it for a minute. Where is physical Babylon? Iraq. Who is it that rules Iraq right now? And don't tell me the people of Iraq, because they don't.
And they're going to rebuild the city.
Who has already rebuilt the city of Babylon? Guess what? It's there. Okay, the city of Babylon is there. I really and truly believe that we are physically Babylon for this time, because we're there ruling it right now. I mean, yeah, we have Iraqi people sitting in a government over there, but it doesn't do anything without our approval. Truly, it doesn't. So we are physically Babylon. We are commercially Babylon, because we fit all of this commercial stuff here. And spiritually, we may not be the mother of harlots, but then again, we might be. Think about it for a minute. What does a harlot do? It sells itself. Okay? So, spiritually, we could be Babylon as well. I'm really frightened for the United States of America, because it has gotten so far away from God. It's gotten so far away, and it's after its own, and couldn't care less about God anymore whatsoever. We are in deep, deep kimchi, folks. Same thing. Kimchi, doo-doo, doo-doo. Kimchi smells like doo-doo. Okay? So that actually smells worse than doo-doo, and therefore that's why I use that. Okay? Deep kimchi. We are in some really stinking stuff, folks, this United States of America. And Yahweh will bring judgment against us. And I think we're reading about it right here. Now, every particular may not happen, but in general, this applies to us, or we can apply this to us.
It's a world system.
It is an absolute world system. It's the new world order.
Yes.
That we are the military arm of. Okay? We are the enforcers for the New World Order. We, as in the United States of America's armies, navy. Why do you think I retired a year early? I realized all of this, and I didn't want to be a part of it. I could have stayed an extra year, but I didn't want to be a part of it anymore. I came out of her. Okay? I mean, I could have gotten a much better retirement if it's there if I'm here when I turn 60. You know, I could have gotten a much better retirement, another whole year at my base pay. Next year? No, not next year. 6 years from now. Nice try there, Liz. Trying to bring me up into your age bracket. Thank you. Well, anyway, so I believe that this can all be applied to the United States. Whether or not it specifically is about us, I don't know, but I'm certain that we can apply it to us. And we are in deep trouble with the God of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
Not only because we've turned our backs on Him, but because we're forcing Israel to turn their backs on Him. Other questions or comments?
A couple comments. It talks about those who were partakers of her, and they'll bewail her and lament her partly because of the fact that they're cut out of the same mold.
Mm-hmm.
These people, they like the world and what everything that the world has to stand for. Now, they do stand far off because they mourn for her, but they're not wanting her judgments.
Right.
You see, they don't want the judgments. But their mourning, I believe, is only because of what was taken from them, as stated in verse 12
mm-hmm.
and 13.
Yes.
You see, they were losing something. I don't know if they really give a hoot who was in charge, just so that they would be able to prosper. The same way that the president of France years ago, when they were trying to form this European Union, said, "We're looking for a leader, be he the devil or whatever. We don't care. Just so we have somebody that can lead us. Not caring about what he was saying and the way he said it. And I believe that this is what these kings of the earth are portraying here. Do our kings, the head of our manufacturing and our other operation, do they give a hoot about us? If they did, we would be doing these things in this country. But you see, they're jobbing them all out for less labor so they can make more money and live more luxuriously, you see. So all these chapters and all the stuff that we're studying, even in Psalms, are all fitting together. It has to do, it's the money, honey, for these people. And the luxury and the way they can live. And the things that they can do. My brother-in-law is very rich. And his mother said to him one time, "How does it feel to be rich and do whatever you want?" And he said, "Pretty damn good." Not thinking of what he was saying. He doesn't know the Lord. He doesn't have anything. His money is going to just dry up and blow away. It's not going to be worth anything. What he really needs is that it's not, and basically it's not worth anything, as Mark said. So if we understand where this is coming from and think, these people are talking about, I got to make money, so I'm going to send my Nike shoes overseas where they make them for a buck or two, and they're selling for $150 here. The Americans will buy them. They're gullible. They'll buy them. Huh? Because they're Nike. That will buy them, you see. And when this all falls, they're going to say, "Oh, who's going to buy them? What's going to happen here?" So, oh, look what happened to them. But I don't want any part of that. And they are a part of it. They're like dominoes.
And it reminds me, when Israel came into Jericho, okay, what is it that Rahab said to the spies? She said, "We've seen what Yahweh did to Egypt. We've seen what Yahweh did to Sihon. We've seen what he did to Og. I don't want any part of that." Okay? Oh boy. Oh boy, smart woman. So she stood back. And she was delivered through the trouble, wasn't she? Because of the scarlet thread that she put in her window. Boy, I'll tell you what. I'll guarantee you, the spies went in there and they got Rahab out and her family, and I'll guarantee you the rest of that wall fell down. Yeah, we'll check it out later on. When we get in the kingdom, when we are in the kingdom in our glorified bodies, in our resurrected bodies, I will not only ask the question, I will go there and see. Yeah, all you people in Paltok, you can come with me. Because, you see, in my resurrection body, I'll be living outside of time and space. I won't be subject to time and space. And I'll be able to go anywhere and anywhen, anytime I want. And so I'll be able to put myself into that timeline, just like Yeshua did. I'll be able to put myself into that timeline and watch what happened in Jericho with my own two eyes. Oh boy. And I'll be able to see. Well, you know what? I always had this theory that Rahab's part of the wall stayed intact until Rahab was gone. Nothing tells us what happened. I think that part of the wall fell down as soon as they came out. What do you think? Let's go have a look. And we'll be able to go right there and look and watch as they bring Rahab out and then watch the wall fall. Or not.
Will you be able to interfere?
I will not be able to interfere, no. I'm not Yahweh. I'm not Yahweh. I can't interfere. Although you know what? Wait a minute. Another strange thought just came into my head. Maybe I'll be an angel who's there to help.
Bring the wall down.
Bring the wall down.
This is going to be one of those
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, you got to think outside the box a little bit. To think like I do, you got to get a little bit outside the box. Maybe I'll be there to actually help bring that wall down. That's too weird, isn't it? Isn't it? But you know what? In Revelation chapter 22, John falls down to worship at the feet of the angel, and the angel says, wait a minute, stop. I'm one of your fellow brethren, a servant of Yahweh. I'm one of your fellow brethren. I'm just a guy. Okay? But he's an angel. Okay? Why can't it be? I'm sorry, but you got to think outside the box. It is cool. It's kind of mind-blowing. Okay, other questions or comments? I'm sorry to get off on tangents like that. Yeah, we're almost done. Questions or comments? No? We shall move on. Verses 17 through the end of the chapter. Okay, remember now. We have just witnessed Yahweh prophesying. Now we're going to see John witnessing. Verse 17, for in 1 hour so great riches has come to naught, and every shipmaster and all the captain, the company in ships and sailors, and as many as trade by sea, stood far off. Notice, we're back to past tense. And cried when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what city is like unto this great city? New York City? Could be. New World Trade Center rehearsal? Could be. And they cast dust on their heads and cried, weeping and wailing, saying, alas, alas, that great city, wherein were made rich all that had ships in the sea by reason of her costliness. For in 1 hour is she made desolate. Rejoice over her, thou heaven, and ye holy apostles and prophets, 24 elders, for God hath avenged you on her. And a mighty angel took up a stone, like a great millstone, and cast it into the sea, saying, thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down, and shall be found no more at all. No more at all is used 5 times from here. And the voice of harpers and musicians and of pipers and of trumpeters shall be heard no more at all in thee. And no craftsman of whatsoever craft he be shall be found any more in thee. And the sound of a millstone shall be heard no more at all in thee. And the light of a candle shall shine no more at all in thee. And the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee. For thy merchants were the great men of the earth, for by thy sorceries were all nations deceived. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth. Great men of the earth, New World Order, the leaders of the New World Order, the Illuminati, those people, and the Illuminati's bosses. Those are the great men of the earth that we're talking about here, I think. The candles won't be needed due to the glow of the radiation. That's why we're not going to need any more candles in here. They're going to be seen no more at all in you, because the radiation is going to, the whole place is just going to glow. Nice. Any questions or comments, please, to verse 24. On anything that we've talked about today.
I was sort of curious about the shipmasters and the sailors. And as I was reading, notice it says they are not restricted to those literally shipmasters, etc., but mainly refers to in a mystical sense to all who share in the spiritual traffic of apostasy Christendom. So I thought that was interesting, that those who sail in ships are the merchants. Those who go down to the sea in ships, they're merchants. And there are going to be some of them that's going to be wailing. And we are to what? Verse 20, rejoice over her judgment and the adversary that comes upon them. Because he's going to avenge, Yahweh's going to avenge his saints. He's the one that's going to do it. He says, vengeance is mine. I will repay, thus saith Yahweh. It will be more than an eye for an eye, but it says it'll be a double for double. And that's not good. I'm going to tell you that right now. That's not good at all. And the violence, the way it takes place, will be great. And that system will be found no more. That system will be completely wiped out. It talks about the music and the workers and the light. But then it talks. But the voice of the bridegroom and the bride is silence. Now the contrast in verse 22:5 in respect to Yahweh's city, it says no candle is needed, for Yeshua will be the light therein. He's going to be the light therein. So is there light at the end of the tunnel? Yes, there is. And Yeshua is that light therein. And that is our hope. Our hope is in Him and no one else or nothing else. Not even in Mark.
Don't put your hope in me. No, sir, I can't deliver. Unless I'm working for Papa John's, in which case I can deliver pizza. Okay. Andy, you are not allowed until after Monday sundown. Sorry. Okay, here we go. And in her, in verse 24, was found the blood of the prophets and of saints and of all that were slain upon the earth. Talking about Babylon the Great. Look back at chapter 17 and verse 6. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Yeshua. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration. It doesn't mean that he admired her. It was with great wonder. Okay? Astonishment. Astonishment. Because here was someone who called herself Christian and yet destroyed the saints. She was drunk on the blood of the saints and of the martyrs. So, that's interesting.
A lot of that's to come, too.
Oh, yeah, that's coming. In verse 6, the woman is drunken on the blood of two different groups, one saints, two martyrs. Are the saints, then, believing and Torah-observant Jews? Neither group will worship the beast or his image. Okay, so we have the saints, perhaps Torah-observant Jews, and the blood of the martyrs of Yeshua, the Torah-observant Messianic.
And some of those are Christians. And one of the Christians that look upon Torah in a different light when they
right.
see... And I truly believe that some of the first ones that's going to die will be Torah-observant people.
Yes.
And then they're going to see that if we die right, we do it the right manner, then they're going to start thinking and, you know...
Exactly. Like the martyrs in Rome.
Right. That's
right. People who were burned alive at the stake.
Right.
And were singing hymns while they were being burned.
Some of the great
never feeling the pain.
Some of the great Christian leaders that were burned at the stake.
Correct. If this woman is the U.S. of A. and the beast is GB... Is the image political Israel? Democracy, American style? Could be. The USA is killing Christians and Jews? The USA killing Christians and Jews? I wondered with great admiration. Could that be? Oh, that could be very well. The United States of America government that has gone completely against God, coming after God's own, and killing off the Christians and the Jews? Absolutely. What do you think all those camps are for?
These so-called Christian people and world leaders are going to Bohemian Grove in California and
right.
worshiping Moloch.
Yeah.
There's movies on it. People snuck in there and took pictures of them. That's what they're doing.
Yep.
It would be the same thing. It's ritually in type. They're worshiping with burnt offerings of babies.
Right.
Like, it's just a symbolic
exactly.
thing of what they do.
That's what abortion is.
Yeah. Well,
that's Moloch worship as well.
Yeah, that's true, too. Moloch worship is abortion.
Yep. Other questions or comments? Anybody in Pal Talk got a question or comment there, Phil? Huh? Pretty interesting what the glorified body can do.
Take a nap in the center of a star.
Look at Yeshua teleported.
Somebody wants you to maybe elaborate a little bit more on the camps here in the U.S., so maybe you'd want to just say what you're talking about further.
Okay, well, there are a number of them. If you if you've been following the news for the last 20 years or so, we've been downsizing our military, and we've been closing bases. I was personally in two different Naval Air Reserve squadrons that were BRAC'd, base realignment and closure. Okay, and we were BRAC'd. Literally, our command, my commands twice were, one was just dissolved, and I had to find a job in another command, and then that command was moved from where it was to another base because they were closing that base. Now, on these bases, they're still government property. They were supposed to have been offered to non-governmental organizations for their own use, and a couple of them were given to those, like the Presidio was closed and given to Gorbachev, and now his organization, I forget what it's called, is headquartered at what used to be the premier army base on the West Coast, the Presidio in San Francisco. In the meanwhile, back in 1984, the Congress passed a little thing called Rex 84. Basically, what Rex 84 did was it created, it took the United States and it broke it down into 10 regions. And each of the regions was to, I believe that was a part of a New World Order thing, that the New World Order was broken down into 10 regions, and the United States is one of them. Okay, maybe North America is one of them now. And they've broken that down into 10 parts. And then each of those will be broken down into 10 parts, okay, until you get down to localities. Basically, it'll be what we see in Revelation chapter 17, where we have 10 kings, okay, 10 kings over the 10 different areas of the world, each of them giving their power to the beast in chapter 17, chapter 13 and 17. Anyway, Rex 84 has been going on since 1984. That's when it was actually signed into law by Ronald Reagan. Whether or not he knew what he was doing when he did that, I don't know. But that was when that happened. In Rex 84 created FEMA and set up the 10 different zones within the United States were FEMA areas, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency would be in the event that the president would declare a state of national emergency, FEMA would become the thing that runs the country. Congress and the Constitution would be dissolved. Constitution would be set aside. Habeas corpus set aside. And in effect, that's what we have under the USA Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Acts. All of these things building on what it had, what came before. The United States of America has become a very, very wicked place, and is becoming more openly wicked all the time. And it's all because our government has done these things over time, under the guise of Christianity. Now, FEMA has set up at least 25 concentration camps all over this country. Congress just passed a law last year creating 20 more set to house at least 20,000 prisoners each. Now, what in the world do they need 400,000 new prison beds for if they are not planning to use them for something? I'm thinking that they're getting ready to take down people like you and me, who are in disagreement with what they're doing for whatever reason and are doing our best to make it known. Okay? Anything else? Did I cover enough of that? Or Anyway, so that's Rex 84, concentration camps. I saw pictures of some of the concentration camps that were built under Rex 84 back in the 80s. There was one great big one outside of Atlanta. It was kind of interesting. It had a center hub building that I believe was probably the administration building, and then it had six corridors at the end of which you would find a ward, I guess you would call it. Well, I would assume that would be different wings of the place where they kept where they would keep the prisoners. All of these things are manned. They have barbed wire fences. They have guard towers. They have barracks, things like that, and nobody in them. I don't know about the one in Alaska specifically. I know the one right outside of Atlanta is huge. And the one that they built in Camp Grayling in northern Michigan is huge. You've been to Grayling?
Yes.
But you didn't see any kind. That was a long time ago. In Mansfield, Ohio? I'm not sure about that. There used to be a reformatory in Mansfield that's not there anymore. Mansfield Reformatory has been used in a lot of movies. It's the place where they filmed The Shawshank Redemption and also, I believe, The Green Mile. Those were both very good movies. A what?
A yard of school buses
in Columbus, just full of school buses. How many acres are we talking about? Many? Many, many? 4 or 5 acres of school buses. You know, you got to get people around. Now, out here at the Ravenna Arsenal, which is not too far away, it's east of Akron, about 15, 20 miles. About 15 years ago, they built a 10,000-foot runway. Now, the Ravenna Arsenal, back in World War II, is where they made all bombs for use by the American military in World War II. Okay? All bullets that were used by our troops, made at the Ravenna Arsenal, a huge facility for building weaponry. Well, they're not using it anymore because we're not building bombs, we're not building bullets. Okay? So this place is still in the hands of the Army. What are they doing with it? And what do they need a 10,000-foot runway? And why did they have to replace all of the railroad tracks going in and out of the place, which are myriad? There are hundreds of tracks going in and out of this place. It's incredible, the hub that they've built there. What are they building this hub for? Okay? I don't have any absolute hard facts because they won't let you on the base. You know, even with my military ID, I was not able to get on that base.
Ravenna.
There's all kinds of, and by the way, there's no fly zone over the Ravenna Arsenal. If they catch you in an airplane, they're taking you down. Okay, it's pretty interesting. Now you'll see military aircraft flying over that way, flying in and out, but you never see a commercial aircraft fly over that. You never see a private aircraft fly over that. So, anyway, just interesting stuff. You see it all. You know the New World Order is coming. You know the biblical prophecy, and you put the two together and you connect the dots. Okay? What I've done is connected dots. That's all. I may have made a mistake, but I'm telling you, I doubt it very seriously.
If it looks like a duck and talks like a duck,
smells like a duck, it quacks like a duck,
not a cow,
it's probably not a cat. Okay. That's logical. Yeah, I've never heard a cat go quack, although they can make some really strange noises. Other questions or comments? I No? We're coming up on, let's see, we've done three hours. 3 hours, 5 minutes, and 30 seconds so far. Are there any other questions or comments on any of the passages of Scripture that we've done today? My wife wants to make a comment about the bathroom. These people don't remember the bathroom anymore.
Okay. But they will after you mention it.
They will after you mention it, though. As a matter of fact, you already mentioned it, so now they remember.
So go ahead.
Go ahead.
There's the mic. There's a mic right next to you. You started it.
No, I'm not going to finish it.
She's not going to finish it.
Do it.
Okay. Hey, we're done. Hey, folks, that's all for the Midrash for today. Thanks for coming. Wiggy, thanks for your input. Wiggy remembers. She knows that if I were her husband and I had said that, she would have whacked me a good one. But anyway, so that's all for the Midrash for today.
Watered Garden says exactly.
We had a good time with you all today. We appreciate you being here. We'd ask that you would come again next week. The Torah passage will be Exodus chapter 13, the entire chapter. I haven't looked up all the rest yet, but I can do that. Give me a second.
Psalm 50 for sure. In the meantime,
yeah, Psalm 50 for sure.
I believe Eddie will be back next week to give us a report on his travels, God willing. So you'll want to make sure and join us for that.
Okay, year 2, Sabbath 4. Exodus 13, verses 1 to 20. Isaiah 46, 3. Is that all? Just Isaiah 46, 3? I can't believe that. Again? 3 and 4. Psalm 50. And Hebrews 8, 6 through 9, 1. And then 9, 13 and 15. Through 15. Let me read that for you again so that you can copy it all. It's going to be Exodus 13, Isaiah 46, 3 and 4, Psalm 50, Hebrews 8, 6 through 9, 1, and 9, 13 to 15. Isn't that interesting? So we're going to be talking about the Levitical priesthood next week and how that relates to 9-1, I'm not sure. Or 9-13 and 15, I'm not sure. But anyway, blood of bulls and goats and all that. Okay, so we'll see you next week. Shalom in Messiah Yeshua. Rico will be on again this Thursday night at 8 o'clock in his room in Pal Talk, Wisdom and Torah. I don't know if you were there for the teaching this past week, but it was awesome. If you get a chance to get in there, do it. Rico is one of the best teachers of Torah I know of. And if you get a chance, please, please get in there and give a listen. Anyway, in Yeshua's name, in the Messiah Yeshua, shalom to you all. Shavuot Tov.
And that's a wrap. Okay. Want to know what are you all wanting to listen to? Do you want a replay of the update or of Midrash or something else from Eddie? We can do whatever. Update. Well, we got a couple for update. What do you want to hear? Anybody else? Thursday at 8. Is
Thursday at 8. So, what are we playing next? Okay. Then that it shall be.
Homie, homie. How you doing? Look at here. We got a little puppy dog coming in today. All right, listen up. Jenna Zuliani.
I just Shalom. And I would like how to welcome you all
with the Santa Flush
to the Baby Axel.
Right?
And someone says, oh, you're...
A hand with a rubber glove and one of those scrubbers, you know, the toilet scrubbers. And what's going into the glove but a male arm? Jenna Zuliani. You should be ashamed of yourself. Okay, you can put the teaching back on.